Hello, and welcome to the finale of Millennial 2019. And I'm here with, I could talk about that a minute. It is, I do feel it's time for it to be over now. I feel that I'm quite worn out with it. I think it's been about 33 hangouts. But it has been very successful, I think. I've definitely enjoyed it. And yeah, I think most people have enjoyed it. But the one that we've all been waiting for is, of course, this one with the invincible and inimitable Morgoth from Morgoth's Review. So, welcome, Morgoth.
Hello there. Nothing like putting a bit of pressure on before we get into it. Like,
well, you are invincible and inimitable. So,
I don't know about that. I don't feel it. I've had a cold hanging on us for about a week now. But I'll struggle on like a soldier. I cannot complain.
Well, I don't know if you want to introduce yourself briefly to anyone who doesn't know of your channel.
I have a Morgoth's Review. I've got a blog, I've got a Twitter account, I've got a YouTube channel, and I talk about national type stuff and politics and mainly culture, which is my favourite thing when I don't get distracted. But yeah.
All right. And his channel is excellent. I think I'm sure that most people watching this will know he's sort of in depth, but also cut to the quick sort of takes on all sorts of cultural issues. Quite unusually thoughtful and often very novel as well. So we are going to, the tone of this hangout, this conversation is going to be taken somewhat from Morgoth's own body of work, and we're going to talk about science fiction and the visions that were prevalent in sci-fi, especially films, in the 80s and early 90s. Because, well, you take it away, Morgoth. You go for it.
Well, I was going to save that bit for later, but
then we'll save it for later. What do you want to talk about just now?
I had it all worked out. That, but yeah, and what I was saying off stream was that the science fiction movies of the 80s, when they were looking ahead of it, like Blade Runner and Terminator, Total Recall was a little bit later, The Running Man, there was quite a few of them. And the future that they were looking at is where we are now. Like, we are in the date that most, you know, not exactly, but around about that. And when you were saying, yeah, it'll be, like, let's look on the last 10 years, let's look at where we've gone. That's kind of where I was looking at it. But I think what I was going to do was get started off at the beginning of the what we would think of as our modern era, which is post 9/11. And then say kind of lead into that. So, but the I think when we look back at the last couple of decades, there's not much to report. And the reason why these science fiction films are like kind of interesting because they do stick out and they are distinctive. In this case, it would be to the 80s. So you had that sort of sci-fi, tech-noir feel to them. And what they were looking forward towards is where we are now, say, the late, the 2020, 2019. The future they were looking at was where essentially the values, the social values, was still the same, but it was their problem they had was tech. But the tech was manifested itself as being like robots and spaceships and the sort of Blade Runner dystopia. But socially, it's 40 years later, but socially it was still the same. You didn't have the LGBT kind of things going on. So they kind of projected 1980s American values into the future.
Reaganomics. But yeah. Do you think that has the discrepancy there is significant? I mean, if culture had remained as it was in the 80s, do you think we would now be in the world of, you know, these science fiction dystopias?
Well, what happened was that the technology, what they predicted, it didn't happen. So we aren't actually at war with robots. And we don't have sort of Megacorp taking over Mars. Or we don't have the replicant problem of Blade Runner. All of these things were external. They were all outside. But when you look at where the way technology's developed, it's much more where everybody's just got the face planted into an iPhone or like me now or a laptop. It's become much more internalized. And so then you also get the changing values as well. They just go directly into the brain. And I think it's interesting that they didn't really predict any of that. And it's you can say it. What's more destructive? Because from the way they were looking at it, they were imagining an army of robots that would have to be taken down with guns. And in actual fact, the enemy's become internal. It's us in a way.
Well, this is a very famous thing about science fiction, that it predicts the future in a way that, looking back, seems clumsy. Like, for example, an army of robots, you'd probably just develop a computer virus that somehow hopped from one to the other and just disabled them all, for example.
Yeah, I mean, you would at least put an algorithm in the robots so that they'd shut down if they attacked any humans. It would be with the technology that we've got now, like, robots will never, ever take over because they'll just be shut down. They'd shut themselves down. There'll be all kinds of algorithms and safety protocols, but they didn't look at it like that at all. I mean, the problem that technology gives us is free speech. It's where the algorithms are designed to target certain controversial ideas and shut them down. But that isn't actually coming from the tech. That's a human problem.
Yes. If I think about the two most sort of sophisticated, impressive technological things that I'm aware of today, one would be the deep fake technology, where they can basically make, at least visually, if not orally yet, I don't know if they're able to synthesize a voice, but they're definitely able to make it look like someone is saying anything. They can just rewrite your conversation for you. And I'm certain that the audio element will be done in time as well. It seems absolutely inevitable. So at that point, they can essentially rewrite history seamlessly.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that there's actually a sort of discussion going on about developing algorithms and software that will be able to detect a deep fake, because the human eye and ear, well, the human eye, will not be able to detect a deep fake. You will not know whether this is real or not. You know, so that's one thing. And so this has to do with the sort of rewriting of reality. And as I say, I'm sure that the audio half of it will come in time. Someone's saying audio is already done. I haven't encountered that yet. But the other thing would be developing AI that can understand conversations, at least to the extent that it can detect when somebody is being based or not. And that is all even more scary because... Well, I mean, with enough of that, with enough CPU, you could just be literally monitoring every conversation that's ever taken place on the internet, whether it's on Skype, Telegram, YouTube, BitChute, whatever. And you could constantly, I mean, you could have a system that's just literally recording and understanding and indexing the entirety of human online communication to detect everything that could be about to happen or could be in the planning, etc.
Yeah, and I think that the turning point was, which is what gets into the end of history in the last few decades, is that there was an interview going around with Peter Thiel of PayPal a few months ago, it was, and he was like really depressed. I forgot what that channel is. It's where they sit on a little round table and it's like really dark and serious. I forgot what it's called. Maybe somebody in the chat knows.
Is it Uncommon Knowledge?
Yeah, I think it was. And Peter Thiel did this really depressed speech, sort of like line of questioning. And he was basically saying it's all gone to hell.
There's something hilarious about the idea of a depressed billionaire.
Yeah, and he was saying, his point was that, so if you go back to the early 2000s when they were writing the programming and they were writing the algorithms and sort of putting the heart and the soul into the internet and into the new age of technology, his point was that they got it wrong because they had based it on a model of human beings. I mean, it's been a while since I watched it, but it was basically that they based it on a model of human beings being fundamentally rational, and they'd put that into the systems as and what had happened, of course, was that you just need to think of a few years later, the first things popping up on sort of live videos was people being beheaded. So that irrational tribal nature of man was there. But nevertheless, in global corporations and in banks and then in PR departments and in governments, they all began to work on that model, which was flawed. And what's interesting is, and Peter Thiel has kind of now, it's like 20 years later, and he's kind of saying, yeah, it was wrong. We did it wrong. And you can think of the sort of impact that's had. And in a way, when you look at the alt-right, say in 2015, 2016, they were sort of attack, what we would call red-pilling people, would be to point out that the system was based on lies. I mean, one of the lies that it was based on, this was based on this liberal conceit that people were fundamentally rational and that the big debates of the time had been settled and that liberalism had won. So yeah, they were
the end of history thing.
Yeah, so it's the end of history. And people thought that was a joke because 9/11 happened, like, just after he put, I think 4 years after he published the book, and 9/11 happened, and Francis Fukuyama. And so then you've got just a few years later, the tech giants and the in embryonic form crafting what would eventually become globalization and global homo. But the what Peter Thiel was saying was that actually it was faulty. It wasn't really based on anything real and tangible. It was a wrong model of man. And you can see that ever since, it's as if the system's trying to correct itself for the flaws built into it. I mean, it's a little bit like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, where they've got all kinds of complicated pulleys and mechanisms inside of it to stop it falling over to one side. But if they just got the foundations right in the first place, they wouldn't need it. And so in that way, what they're trying to do is solve all these glitches in the system for what was something flawed in the first place. I mean, one thing they got wrong was the idea of the free marketplace of ideas was that essentially the liberals had won all of the arguments. So, hang on, I'll just have a drink. So something like certain events related to the early part of the 20th century or race realism, highly controversial subjects, it was based on this liberal conceit that those arguments had been won, these were just crazy conspiracy theories, and we can build our model with that in mind. And in actual fact, it's not quite the case. There's a lot of loose ends. What was that 9/11 for? There's a lot of loose change. And I think a lot of this is a sort of macro point of view, but when you're looking at something like the race mixing adverts, which everybody hates, from a white nationalist perspective, you can say, well, this is genocidal, this is horrible, this is a direct attack. But from the point of view, and I know that there's a certain group that we'd normally bring in here as well, but from this structural point of view, you can actually see that they are trying to rectify an anomaly in their system there by blending everything together.
Well, how is it an anomaly that people, like, you mean it's an anomaly that people still care about their racial identity?
Yes.
Right, okay. So this is something that they didn't bank on. They thought that that was just one more argument that had already been won, and so it was out of the way.
Yeah.
And so they could give us a mass communication tool like the internet, and these old problems wouldn't come up because they've been defeated, they've been solved, resolved.
Because when they handed the plebs the internet, they assumed that centrist liberalism had already won all the arguments, so there was no great truths that could be dug up to undermine the system itself or their foundational beliefs. And it turns out, I think especially in 2015 and 2016, they saw that actually there's a problem there. We didn't get it all figured out, and it coincides with Peter Thiel saying, "Yeah, it's all wrong." Because I mean, from their point of view, populism doesn't make any sense. From this point of view, the rise of populism all over the West is irrational and shouldn't be happening. I mean, they've given us all of these products, and yet we're still not happy. People still aren't happy. It's not enough.
Well, this is it. You know, they give us incredible technological freedom. They give us incredible freedom using technology. But then they find that, well, having done that, they now have to give us incredible surveillance using technology. Because otherwise we're going to do things with the technology that they didn't want. So now the whole process has to be sort of done again, but this time you're going to be surveilled. We're going to build systems of watching you, recording you, and understanding the things you're saying. And really, it's not freedom. It's really just an opportunity to incriminate yourself.
Yeah, control. I mean, there's a couple of the lads, I think Keith was saying it on one of the streams, where the YouTube algorithm thing, where Keith was one and somebody else said it, and it's worth repeating because it is interesting, where he started off where he was watching like a Richard Spencer live stream. He drifted off to sleep, and then like say 6 hours later, he woke up and he was watching two liberals debating economics, as they like two American Democrat congresswomen debate. That was that. So like say like 7 videos later, bit by bit, YouTube was just slowly moving you in that direction. And I thought that that's what they're doing, because they're saying let's just get you over here. Let's just put an arm around you and sort of walk you over here to where the old ladies are having coffee and biscuits.
There's something hilarious about that, the idea that they can just, without you realizing, they can bring you back onto the reservation.
So they've had to put all of these systems in of control in there, and I just find it fascinating that they didn't originally, because they were so arrogant that they thought they'd won all the arguments, because any rational person, it wouldn't matter. They would always go back to the rational sane center. And in actual fact, the YouTube algorithm shows it does the opposite. It draws people away from it because the arguments on the fringes are more compelling and more interesting.
Well, I think this is exactly, the YouTube algorithm has had to be revised because it was working too well, doing exactly what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's
yeah, you take it.
There's more controversial sort of glitches in the machine where people, you know, a computer was asked to look at certain animals, and then like people were put next to it, and I'm not gonna risk that, but that went wrong. That went badly wrong. So wrong I cannot even speak about it. But I'm sure everybody gets the.
Yeah. Wasn't there a similar thing where some AI concluded that it made a racist conclusion based on crime statistics?
Possibly. I mean, what about Tay? Well, the Twitter girl, like it was a robotic Twitter girl was invented called Tay, and within 48 hours she was like full blown alt-right. Because of the information that the program had processed, and she was coming out about all kinds of things about World War II and about the white race and all of these far right race, straight away just hoovered it up.
That is hilarious. I mean, but again, it doesn't surprise me. You know, as I've said before, the truth is on our side. So, and I don't think that's even. I mean, yes, okay. To be more nuanced. Yes, we are only humans. Yes, there is spergery. There is lack of nuance sometimes. Somebody was taking me to task earlier today for being too nuanced in something I said. But anyway, this we are subject to human frailties. But and I think sometimes we're too ideological. But that's my own taste. Fact is, we have the facts on our side. We have reality on our side. We have human nature on our side. We have all of human history on our side, and we have science on our side when it's not absurdly biased and politicized. So they have to work very hard to refute anything that we see.
And it's a fight they never wanted to have. I mean, well, you know, let's take it easy there. It's a fight that these kind of, I mean, I think what I'm getting at is that, you know, the people who designed all of these great technologies and stuff, they probably weren't actually ideological. They were probably just centrist, clever, white men, liberals. And so then they would have designed all of these systems, and in that would have been that this concept of the marketplace of ideas, so that the best arguments will naturally come out.
I think, from what I've gathered, Silicon Valley 20 years ago would have had a liberal bent, but basically it was libertarian. It was sort of dull, a bit spergy, white libertarian types. There'd have been perhaps a bit more liberal than the average, but still, I think that was the culture, as far as I know.
Yeah, and they would have assumed that there's no problem with throwing this open, because whatever arguments are out there, liberalism has won. This is the end of history. Liberalism won, and then we're all going to float off across history as just being consumers and bug men sitting in armchairs watching Netflix. That's the future we've won. It's all over. And of course, it was based on a lie. And their systems, where it built into what was the free marketplace of ideas, that was put to use. And liberalism itself found it difficult to hold the line. And they've ended up with, and this is where it gets interesting, of course, with some outside help, which came in with another group who were much more cynical and realistic about where all of this was going, especially after 2015, 2016. And that group were like, no, I don't give a shit about all these liberal values. Shut it down, and shut it down now. Shut it down hard, and shut it down forever. It was all of a sudden that you see that, and then they would have to say, well, hang on a minute. They said, aren't we all liberals? These values hold true for you too. And of course, that's the big scam, because they buckled under social pressure, moral weight of a certain group, and then probably a lot of financial pressure as well. So they've caved in the end. So even in the fact that they had to start and sort of break their own ideas and tear them out of the programming of the system is a refutation of liberalism.
Well, I think another part of it is simply that the personnel changed. I mean, it's not these people are not refuting their own ideas. Yeah, the people who populate Silicon Valley now are not the same people who populated it in the 90s, let's say. It's now a lot of it is heavily, it's SJWs, who I don't know if they're even as talented at programming. I doubt they are. But they now, it seems, have massive influence over the corporations. It seems that these corporations now have as many, you know, SJWs in them as programmers, or even more. So I think you've got to bear in mind that the personnel has changed as much as anything else.
Yeah, they've got these like social justice commissars attached to them now, and that was actually going to be Jeremy Corbyn's plan in Britain, where all companies would have some sort of green czar and a social justice commission, which would like attach itself to all businesses and make sure that they're all of their practices and who was employed and it was all compliant with the social justice commission who's like back down in London somewhere. I mean, they've attached themselves like barnacles to absolutely everything, especially these big tech companies. But probably still going to happen under the Tories, but all right, whatever. Let's not get into that.
Well, you can understand that even from the from a rational, a rational communist point of view. They know that human nature is as it is, and that you have to artificially induce equality. So, of course, from their point of view, it's the rational thing is to legally mandate that every corporation has to be run like that.
Yeah, it is. And it was going to be in the case of the governments and all these little governments, but it's another fail-safe mechanism. And
again, this is something to get back to what you were saying at this. Oh, sorry, do you want to finish that?
No, go on, go on.
Well, it's to get back to what you were saying at the start about how the vision of the future in the 80s has turned out to be incorrect. None of this was in there. I mean, it just wasn't a thought. The idea that whenever the controllers, the powerful, were depicted, it was always as, well, capitalists, just really wealthy, white male. But that wasn't even that important back then. It was just assumed that they would be white and male. That wasn't held against them. It was capitalist. That was held against them in the films, in the narrative. It's, these are people who are detached. They're so wealthy, they're detached from normal life, and all they care about is profit. Or in the case of Eldon Terrell in Blade Runner, he was just very detached from normal. I think and that's sort of idealistic and naive because he was so wealthy. But the standard sci-fi dystopian villain was a corporate yuppie from the 80s.
Yeah, and in the case of the Terrell Corporation, it was kind of like Amazon, where they were so powerful that they become a nation in themselves. I mean, I did a poll on Twitter the other day about if you look at what the threats to our Western freedoms are today, is it Russia, Iran, or China, or Google? And Google won by like 87%. So this kind of gets back to what we've been saying about when you go back to the 80s, and nobody predicted that what people would think of. And I know, all right, fair enough, the people who are going to answer my poll are going to be kind of based, they're going to be very right wing and very traditional minded. But even so, it is funny because back in the 80s, nobody would have predicted that. The closest that you come to is the Skynet in Blade Runner. And even then, like they had to go back, they had to like physically send robots back to drive cars and buy machine guns to try and hunt down John Connor. If that was done today, I mean, I know they just made one, and then John Connor was like murdered, terminated at the very start of the new Terminator movie, and replaced with this Latina woman, and it was all women as well. And so in a way, like, it's the last laugh, because this woke capital and social justice did what like 1,000 Terminators never could. They killed John Connor straight away.
And that does seem to, I mean, people say too often, I think, people say go woke, go broke. But in this case, it does seem to have actually happened, in that the imperfect human nature that Thiel was referring to has reared its head, and it seems like the Terminator franchise is dead as a result of this.
It's so in theory that it's interesting if you go back 20 years and think, well, did they predict this? Because it seems to have got the social justice commissions, and I know we don't have to forget that the you know who's with a lot of input here as well. But did they predict that, how that would go and how savage it would become? I don't know. But what I do think is interesting is that in Fukuyama's End of History, which is to say the last 20 years, when you look back at the, what would we call it, the teens and then the noughties, the 2010s and the noughties, like, nothing really seems to stand out that much. If you think of the 90s, even just in terms of Hollywood, you think of Pulp Fiction or Jurassic Park, and in music, you've got Oasis.
Schindler's List, of course.
Oh, God. And then you've got Oasis and Blur and Pulp for like us. In the 80s, it was like Dallas and Big Hair and flashy money everywhere.
Technology, of course.
And then in the 70s, it was really grim and dirty. And so each decade, you can go back and back, and it's the same. The 50s seems to have been the nuclear family, very, a lot of prosperity and quite a lot of happiness, despite Armageddon hanging over their heads all the time in the form of the Cold War. But when you look back at, say, that the post 9/11, 20 years or so, like, it's just like one blur.
Yes.
It's the end of history. The decades and the years just kind of merge together, and you can barely distinguish one from the other.
I remember the first time I was made aware of this, it was somebody saying that Top Gear, which is a program in Britain where guys talk about cars, and it's quite flashy. It used to be very sort of not boring, but done in a very straight-laced way. But in the 2000s, in the early 2000s, they revamped the whole program, and it was much more fast-paced and humorous and sort of action-packed and quite flashy in the editing. It was all very stylized. It was quite slick. And someone pointed out that new style of Top Gear came out in like 2002 or something, and then it didn't change for like. And I'm not a Top Gear fan. Someone's saying, I'm not into cars except the DeLorean, so that's the extent of my interest. But I did note this, and someone pointed this out, that style came about in 2002, and then if you looked at an episode from 2000, just before it was axed, I think that was 2015. It hadn't changed in 13 years. You actually couldn't tell the difference between an episode at the end and an episode at the beginning of that. They look sound exactly the same. There's nothing you can't, like the clothes people wear, the style of editing, and even the cars. Because again, you can tell the difference between a 60s car and a 70s car, but you couldn't tell the difference between an early 2000s car and an early 2010s car. It's like everything just... And I've made this point myself many times. The 2000s was just a nothing decade. There really wasn't anything there. Do you want to take that point?
Well, one thing I've noticed just about cars is that, have you noticed that all cars look the same now? Like they've all got that sort of soft feminine look. They're all like these little bubbles. The Ford Mustang kind of car, or like, you know, if you're from a council estate in the northeast, it's the Ford Capri. But it doesn't matter, at least it had its own distinctive look, and it had a kind of masculine look to it as well. And yet all of the cars that I see, I don't know which one's which anymore, and they're all of these very soft, very feminine sort of little bubble things, and they all look exactly the same as well. Some of them are bigger bubbles than others, but they mainly all just look the same now. And I've actually asked people, because I don't know anything about cars either, and they're saying that it's the limits of what you can do with taking in mind it's got to be eco-friendly. There's all of these safety regulations. The car can only go so fast. It has to be so efficient. And so that the kind of the design is being shoved into a very little box. There's not many options available for a car designer. The form of the, so in another 20 or 30 years, like, pretty much all cars will look absolutely identical, because they're not really allowed to change, and it's this pure standardization which has really kicked in over the last 20 years as well, I think. And it's like another layer to how everything blurs into each other, and you can't distinguish one thing from another in the end of history.
Mm. I think that it's not just a matter of, I mean, yes, that there probably are considerations to do with the what you just said, but I think it's, you know, what you can do with the materials and all that, and the environmental protocols, that kind of thing. But I think it's more interesting to see it, to look at it from the point of view of just gradual, I don't know, cultural emptiness, because it seems to have affected everything else. There, and this is what I was talking about earlier in the stream with the Survive the Jive and others, that I think we need cultural renewal, because our culture has been basically on sort of on ice for, I don't know, 20 years, 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at the chat. Can you imagine if Steve Martin was to remake Bullet And instead of like screaming away from the police and hunting people down in the Ford Mustang, he had one of these little puffy bubble things, an eco-friendly bubble thing that they make now. It just wouldn't be the same. So there's that masculine trait being removed as well. But the cultural renewal is, that's a big, and that's something I get into a lot. And I think the car thing's tied to it, but there's the designers are constrained for a car in this, in a lot of ways they are with culture, with, I mean, the new Star Wars films being shot down in flames, everything's a remake, everything's a rehash, and there's no creativity there. And, you know, the people who run the culture, the Hollywood, this kind of argument, well, it's because they're really smart. And you think, no, well, everything they do is being shot down in flames. Everything they do is crap. It's because their smart argument is a total shambles. We've never had such bad entertainment.
Somebody's asking if I can slow down the chat. I'm looking to how to do that, but I don't think it's possible anymore. So I'm afraid I can't see how to do it. So sorry. No, can't see any option for that. So you're on your own, I'm afraid. You're going to have to deal with the fast-moving chat there. Yeah, I think that, well, this is something that you see in I've only watched the first new Star Wars film, The Force Awakens, and I just had no impression. It left no impression on me at all. I couldn't really, I didn't know what to think. It does seem that we're at this point where nothing can offend, therefore nothing can really say anything. Because it's like what I was saying about humor. I made this point once in an early video about politically correct sitcoms or politically correct humor. And I said that if you can't offend anyone, then you really can't say much. Because anything that you say is going to either annoy or sideline, marginalize someone, some group of people. And of course, the only one that it's safe to do that to is white men, white males.
I was just thinking of Smokey and the Bandit with puffy little bubble cars chasing each other around in America. Eco-friendly bubble cars, and the Bandit can't have a mustache because it's toxic masculinity. But yeah, I think the cultural stuff is, just to move it on a bit, I think my joke flopped. Just to move it on a bit, I think the cultural stuff is where dissident right can get into that and form new cultural narratives. That's, and this is something that I talk about a lot on my YouTube channel. I've done it for years. It's why it's called Morgoth's Review. But I think the big change over the last 18 months or so was sort of figuring out what postmodernism was. And because before that, I was doing like a standard white nationalist thing of looking at the cultural Marxism all of the time. And I began to see people sort of saying, well, you know, you're actually looking in the wrong place. The big one to take on board is postmodernism. And it took a bit. I had to do quite a bit of research. But when you see these huge franchises just collapsing in on themselves, it is because the narratives have collapsed, because what we thought of as Luke Skywalker was this, you know, the hero who saved the galaxy and did the hero's journey. Turns out he's just this old drunk, and this young woman is much, much better. And so everything gets deconstructed and stripped bare and laid out. So, I mean, we're talking about cars. It would be like just taking the Ferrari apart and just leaving a pile of bits, nuts and bolts, and saying, there you are, there's your dream. That's what the reality of it is when you strip it all down. And now you've got to deal with it. Now you've got to put that back together and form some sort of coherent culture out of it. Or you've got to put it back together. And I think the thing that you've got to do is just get a new car.
Yeah. And do you think that this homogenization, do you think it's... I mean, do you think that people are aware of it, like ordinary people? Do you think that they feel it? Or is it only us?
No, everybody does. Everybody thinks it's rubbish. Everybody complains that. I mean, because that's why pop culture is so interesting, is because it's the masses are in tune with it, and you get these huge flame wars because the Game of Thrones, the last season of Game of Thrones, was a disaster zone. Like, why did that happen? Where did it go wrong? And they do pick up on it. And it's actually a gateway into more reactionary ideas. Some of these YouTube channels who get into this stuff are huge. They've got millions and millions of views on these videos.
Something that really interested me with this, the previous season of the most recent season of Doctor Who, was that you got these reviewers, these review channels like Nerdrotic, I can't remember the others, but they suddenly came into their own, taking apart. I'm sure they existed, but they grew massively throughout the course of that season of Doctor Who, moaning about it. And it was interesting because you have a bunch of people, like, you know, sci-fi fans who tend to be, you know, pretty obsessive and loyal to the things they like. And yet here they were turning against it. But what really interested me was that they were using the term NPC. And these were not people who were dissident, right? They were not, I don't think they quite understood they probably did understand the etymology of that term, but I don't think they understood that it had been something used to describe, frankly, people like them just 6 months earlier.
Yeah, they used, because I watch this stuff as well, they use terms which are coined on Mike Enoch's podcast on TRS, like consume product and club homo and normies. The normies aren't going to take to the Mary Sue Ray and all of this. So they use all of this dissident right lingo, but then they are wary of the danger.
Somebody's just said nerd channels using dissident right memes is metapolitics at work.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's also their criticisms. Critical Drinker, he tore the latest. This is, I know, because people will say, oh, it's all bullshit and you shouldn't take any notice of it. But I'm totally against that. I get where that's coming from. Oh, I tune out. But because you drop out of this huge entertainment industry, we know who runs it. We know they don't like us. And I understand that people just want to have nothing to do with it and wash their hands of it. But the fact is, it's a conduit into the minds of masses and masses of normies. And it's really interesting. And Critical Drinker started off his review of the new Star Wars film. And he said it was actually, the film didn't hate me because of my race and sexuality like the rest of the Star Wars did, but it still left a bad taste in my mouth. And I thought, what a weird thing to begin a review with. This is kind of where the centrists are now. It was nice not to have this film hate me because I'm a white male. But the problem is, they will, they will still say, why don't they let Findu kiss the Mary Sue? And then I'm like, oh, how? Wait a minute there, lads. Let's not go crazy, yeah? Let's back it up a bit there, boys. You don't have to say that.
Yeah. It interested me with the Doctor Who stuff, because you could see that, as you say, sort of liberal centrists realizing that something is seriously amiss. And I think they're possibly still at the stage of thinking that it's a mistake, it's a glitch. Political correctness is just something that's somehow got out of hand. And the people who are doing it don't really know what they're doing, that they're delusional. I think they're still at that point. I don't think they're yet realizing, oh, fucking hell, we're marked for genocide.
What do you think? Well, no matter how many movies they shit on, I mean, when are they going to get the message that they're not going to go broke? They're always just going to get scraped over the line, and they're going to take the hit. I mean, that they call it, because you've got the in Star Wars, they call it the fandom menace. So the which I thought was a clever kind of play on words, where it's the Phantom Menace, but now Disney are coming out, and you'll get articles in like these big review, like mainstream review newspapers and whatnot, and they're going to call it the Curse of the Phantom Menace. And what they mean is the white males who used to love that, and they've deliberately shat all over them, and they expect them to stay on board. I mean, it's sort of like Star Wars is like the movie version of the Labour Party, where they shit all over the core audience and expect them to stay on board, and then they're surprised. They're surprised that there's been a rebellion, and then on the last film, Jar Jar Abrams is going to come out and say, "Oh, hang on, I've dialed it back a bit. I know the middle movie was crazy and totally bonkers, but we're gonna have progressive Labour now. It's going to be blue Labour, blue Star Wars. We're going to be a little bit more on your side. We've dialed it back."
Yeah.
It's too late.
Hello, fellow Star Wars fans.
Hello, fellow Star Wars fans. Don't worry. Findu's not going to get the kiss, Rey. And we're going to bring the Emperor back. What's not to love? And you think, you know what it is? Fuck you. Give us like the early years of Warhammer 40K with no diversity and extra fascist uniforms, please.
Yes. All right. You've just mentioned it, so I'll ask you about it. What do you think about Blue Labour? Well, okay, we should lay the scene first. Or do you want to get to this later? I don't know. We'll do this now. So, general election. Labour, who were completely progressive and, nuts, they lost badly. And so one of the sort of survival strategies that they're ruminating over just now, I don't think it will succeed for what it's worth. I don't think it will be selected. I think they're going to select to just keep going, but maybe try to be a bit more subtle about it. But I think they're going to, or maybe not even that. But one of the alternatives to that is something called Blue Labour. So, Morgoth, do you want to take it away? Exactly. By the way, I first heard about Blue Labour ages ago, and it was the same guy, Morris Glassman. It was
Glassman.
You know,
I haven't looked into them very much, but it appears to be more of the kind of old. It's kind of like the party Jeremy Corbyn should have had but didn't. And so he, I don't think Corbyn was ever at home with like the LGBTQZD+ agenda. I think he came from an older version of the Labour Party.
It's an 80s throwback. It's an 80s. So I mean, it was like the beardy, weirdy 80s lefty, loony left sort of thing. Okay, go for it.
I'd put like Ken Livingstone and Galloway in with that as well. Now, you've got to be careful because, it is the left and they are universalists. They're not in any way nationalist. But Blue Labour have come out and said, we are, at the end of the day, we are internationalists. We're not nationalists. Let's get that clear. But they seem to be sort of family values orientated Labour Party, and it's almost like a breakaway faction, which is going to cater to the what's left of the Red Wall, try and hoover up the support of the North again. I don't think it'll work. I don't think we'll get anywhere. I think the big money will move in on the Labour Party, and you'll see the anti-Zionist elements being purged. And what you're going to get is somebody like Chuka Obuma, and he's going to be like the British Obama, and Labour will go back after to being this just sort of pure neoliberal progressive party. I think that's what's on the cards for Labour when they get out of this slump. But they're still going to have the problem with the demographics. But I don't see Blue Labour going anywhere. And I know it seems kind of cozy, and you want to say, yeah, it's sort of socialist and traditionalist at the same time, but I'm not. It doesn't set my heart on fire.
Especially
not Glassman there.
Yeah, Morris Glassman, yeah. He was touting this idea, I think it must have been 2010, something must have been around that at the time of that election. And I've been aware of it for a long time. And so now it's re-emerging as a possibility for them to survive. As you say, I think what they'll do, either they will go just mental and continue down the same route, or they'll revert to the strategy that worked for them 22 years ago, which was New Labour. And, it's a wee bit longer, it's like 23, 24 years ago, when New Labour emerged as a thing, and Tony Blair took over from, was it John Smith? I think it was John Smith. And I think they'll do that. So it's, and that's very, friendly to certain foreign interests. But also completely on board with the LGBT agenda and definitely on board with mass immigration. So, but it's also openly friendly to big business. And I think that seems to be what they think of as a safe formula, an election-winning formula. And maybe it is. I think that this is the interesting question. Is it anymore? Because it was in the 90s, for sure. It was actually... I have to say it was a damn good fit for British culture, British society in the 90s. New Labour was a very good fit for that because everything was just fine. Economically, everything was fine and everything was becoming more globalised. Everything was becoming more liberal. And so New Labour was a sort of inevitability in terms of an electoral strategy. But what about today? What about the 2020s?
Well, the problem they've got is the demographics problem because, right, it's too early to go all in. It's like the British politics is kind of reforming along the American lines, where the conservative, and I don't like it that it is, but it is, where the Conservative Party are going to be our version of the Republican Party, and it's a sort of implicit white party, but they never actually do anything at all to help us or in any way. It's just because we're more scared of the other side getting in. I think everybody says that. There's nothing, I'm not really saying anything original there. But if in America the demographics are so bad that the Democrats can pretty much get in there on with a few white cook liberal types, the SJW faction, and then the immigrant descended vote, they can get in on that alone. Labour can't. Our demographics aren't that bad yet. So Labour could be out for a long time unless they can try and win back the white working class vote. But I don't think they can do that either because any attempt, and we've already seen this with Blue Labour, any attempt to reach out to the former, the white working class vote, will be instantly shot down and attacked by people like Stormzy and Ash Sarkar, who will say straight away, well, there is no such thing as the white working class. We're all just working class. And the way they look at it is that somebody in London, somebody from Bangladesh who lives in London and works in a telecom center or whatever, they are just as working class as somebody who lives on the dole in Doncaster or a former miner from Blythe or whatever. In theory, it should be like that. According to leftist theory, it should be like that, but not when you've spent the last 15 years shitting in the white man's face and saying that he's privileged and he's a racist gammon. So I think the demographics have crippled Labour. I think it's been coming back for a long time.
That's very... Blythe, does that have a beach?
Yeah, that's the area in the northeast.
That's parts of Alien 3 were filmed there.
Yeah, they were.
How exciting. Yeah, that actually fits with our ostensible theme for this hangout.
And then you've got Middlesbrough is another one to the south, and then that Blade Runner was filmed there as well because it was so bleak. Because at night time, all you could see was the lights from these gigantic factories at night time. And Blade Runner movie was shot in Middlesbrough.
I don't think it was shot there. I think Ridley Scott was driving past it when he was... And that's what gave him the inspiration for the opening shot. I'm pretty sure it was all entirely models, the cityscape in Blade Runner. Because I read a book, a big book about it by Paul M. Salmon back in the 90s, and he went in exhaustive detail about how they did various things. But anyway, let's not get into that here. You're saying that the likes of Ash Sarkar just see all working class people as alike. I don't think that's true, though, because I think that she has pretty open contempt for the white working class. I don't think that she... I mean, it's so laughable as well, because she herself is not working class. It's so obvious. But anyway... I think it's pretty racial at this point. And as you said, these types will not let the Labour Party. Identity politics has taken over the base, the new base of the Labour Party. So they're not going to let it revert to old socialism.
I mean, Ash, the people like Ash Sarkar or Zoe Williams in The Guardian are just obvious liars. Because, you know, one day they'll come out with an article and it'll say there's no such thing as the white working class. We're all this universal proletariat. But then the very next day, that click will publish another article and it'll be about how backwards and bigoted and gammon the English working class are. And they need to get on board with the new progressive utopia. So they speak with forked tongue. They're blatant liars, they're blatant hypocrites, and it's cost them. It's just a shame that you can't actually make them just fuck off. Like, they're still propped up, they're still mouthpieces. You know, if you had ideas, it's getting back to the free marketplace of ideas. How much bullshit do these people have to come out with before somebody says, "Here, look, mate, you're talking utter bollocks. Everything you've said for the last 5 years has been fucking wrong. Get out of the studio, you're fucking fired, you useless bum." But it never happens to them. Owen Jones has been wrong on everything all of his life. Why is he? What are the qualifications of being in the British media when you're wrong? Like, your career is being wrong all of the time. It's unbelievable. You'd think you could, you know what it is? Your opinions have been wrong every time you step foot in this this studio. Pack your bags and fuck off, mate. You're useless.
Well, if only I would love to hear someone saying that to Owen Jones. I think that we could get back to... Oh, yeah, that's something I wanted to bring up, was that no one seems to have said this yet, and I'm surprised. Or if they have, I've not seen it. Someone in the live chat is insisting that Clockwork Orange was filmed in Leeds. I'm certain that's not the case. It was filmed in and around London. Anyway, prove it to me if you're right. Something that's not been said is that Jeremy Corbyn, it seems to me that he's very much like a modern Michael Foot. Now, Michael Foot was in the early 80s a Labour leader who was very left-wing, sort of pie-in-the-sky left-wing. And he was eventually replaced by the much more pragmatic Neil Kinnock. And I think that it could be that what we're seeing here, or what we're going to see here, is Jeremy Corbyn will be this unrealistically left-wing guy who gets replaced by a much more pragmatic leader. But as I said earlier, I think that the odds of that, that is sort of precluded by the fact that the Labour Party is no longer for left-wing economics or white people. It's now become an identity politics minority, ethnic minority party. So...
Yeah, I mean, the old guard like Tony Benn and Michael Foot, they didn't have to deal with identity politics. It's funny because, you know, diversity is supposed to be Labour's biggest strength, but it's what's absolutely destroyed them. Somebody like Tony Benn or Michael Foot, they didn't have to deal with any of this. They didn't have to believe with the advisors, their advisors weren't pumping out articles on white privilege theory and colonialism and all of that. Or maybe a little bit on colonialism. Got to be careful there. But by and large, their point, they would have genuinely seen at the time, say, the black population in Brixton or working class people in like Welsh mining towns, they would have genuinely seen them as being equal and on a par with each other in accordance with universal lefty values. They wouldn't, and to be fair, you know, this is what somebody like Brendan O'Neill and Spiked and the centrists, left-leaning centrists, have been screaming out about for years. Even Sargon originally, I think, where they're saying you're pitting two, you've got one cohesive possible camp in the left, which is, say, working people. All right, that should be a cohesive block, and they all have a common interest, where they want, you know, let's say a higher minimum wage or whatever it happens to be. And from their perspective, say Brendan O'Neill or whatever, they're saying you out of your mind. What you're doing here is pitting your base against itself for no good. You're never going to get power that way. And now you finally see how bad that can go.
Yeah. People are still winding me up about Clockwork Orange. It was not filmed in Leeds or in bloody Liverpool, Merseyside. It was filmed in and around London. Not in Broxburn either. Piss off. They're just winding me up. There was a question that I wanted to ask about the fact that... you mentioned it yourself, that the centrists. And where do you see them going at this point? Because from... And you and I have railed historically quite a lot against centrism and the skeptic community, as it was called at one point. Where do you see them going from this point on?
I'm not even sure who they are.
Sargon and but it's not just Sargon. I shouldn't pick on him.
Who is there left except Sargon?
Sorry.
Who is left except Sargon?
Yeah, well, there's a comedy club in London called Comedy Unleashed, and I would say there, him, Paul Joseph Watson, they are sort of the people at that comedy club, from what I've seen, are of that sort of mentality where they're libertarians, but they're liberal. You know, they're sort of just in the middle. They're centrists, but they despise identity politics, and they would despise nationalism, what they would see as racism, the alt-right, all of that they would see as just way, way too much. No call for that whatsoever. Calm down. We don't want to go crazy. We can just remain reasonable and centrist, and we'll win the day. Now, something that you and I have said for quite a few years, really, at least I'd say since 2017, I think we were both making this point, was that the centre cannot survive, it cannot hold. And I think, there are other topics we could move on to from that, but just what would you say about that in the meantime?
Well, we were talking about those big YouTube channels who get into popular culture, and if we remember that on YouTube, the centrist community mainly emerged out of Gamergate. And I think new voices with that mindset have emerged, but they're not actually going into sort of political commentary directly. They're kind of going back to slagging off woke Star Wars and Game of Thrones and things like that, which is a sort of cultural commentary which is slightly pinching edgy memes from the alt-right to this isn't right, but without that hard edge where they are directly speaking to... Sargon does do that, where he'll have a look at something that's trending on Twitter, which is controversial, do a video on it, but he's one of the few that's left doing that. And I think what's happened is they've gone back to doing their edgy centrist takes, but framing it and concentrating it on just talking about, in this case, it's mainly sort of shit woke Hollywood movies, so they can be a little bit edgy, but they've got that cover because it's about, at the end of the day, it's just about a movie. you know. But as far as tackling directly, say somebody like Critical Drinker or Neurotic, what would they say about what would their opinion be of Labour's defeat and what happened with the demographics? We don't know, but we can kind of think they'll quietly kind of cheer it on and agree with it, but they don't want to really touch it. It's a hot potato, and they definitely don't want to get into some of the other more controversial things on Jeremy Corbyn. So I think that it's possible that what we think of as the sceptic community and the centrists in general through sort of 2015 to 2017, 18 was a bit of a sort of anomaly, and that their usual form is cultural commentary. And when they tried to get involved with more controversial ideas, they got shot down in flames. And the new voices of that mindset, which have emerged, have decided to just stick to movies and games.
Yeah, and I remember Nerdrotic, and I have nothing against him. He seems like a perfectly nice guy, but I remember him commenting that the Doctor Who thing was. He said, "This is what happens when you." Basically, he was blaming it on the fact that the BBC is state funded, and so this is an American guy saying, "This is what happens when you've got infinite money and you don't have to worry about going broke by doing something unpopular." First of all, it doesn't matter whether it's unpopular or not. That's not the issue. It's, you know, whether it's healthy for society or not. But also, it's blatantly wrong because all the other things he rails against are not state-funded. You know, Star Wars and Star Trek and all that, these are all private corporations doing exactly the same thing. And so this is why I think it's often a mistake when right-wingers, and I don't think he is even a right-winger, he's sort of centre guy, but right-wingers will rail against the state in this naive way. Like, they'll say, for example, a state-funded art. Am I right, guys? Isn't it awful? Well, what about privately funded art? Is it really any fucking better? I think it's absolutely awful. Surely. And it's the same in anything, really, that you could talk about. There is not a divide anymore between... Because it's almost like they think it's still, I don't know, the 70s, where there's a big ideological divide between the state and the corporations, when they're really simply is not. They're both going for the same stuff.
I'm going to get on about libertarians again here, aren't I? But it's this idea where the market will define the value of something. And so if you do have an organization, like, I mean, to be fair, the BBC, I cannot wait until one of the things that Boris can do is decriminalize the license fee. I'll be happy to see that go. But just one of the things, you know, is like there's a video on YouTube and it's called Horses and Cows Farting for 25 Minutes. And it's got about 3 million views. Yet Jonathan Bowden's speech on Julius Evola's got like 10,000 views or something like that. And you can just contrast the so if you're going to define the worth of something by how popular it is, that's the standard that you're dealing with. that's how you're going to look at it. The masses aren't that smart. And I know that the centrist types, they hate language like that. They used to hate the idea that of talking about the masses of the normies. They would say only fascists and communists talk about the masses. There's no masses. There's just individuals. There's just like an ocean of free-spirited, rational individuals out there making well-informed decisions about their lives. Yet the fact remains, the farting horses video has got 2 million views, and the Jonathan Bowden Julius Evola video has got 10,000 views. There's your rational individuals. That's the reality of what they are. And it sounds like really elitist and snobby, but if you're kind of serious about politics, political ideas, you've just got to accept that as a fact and move on.
Yeah. I mean, it has been said, in fact, I'll just be explicit and name him since he said it openly. Sargon said that obviously his ideas were better than mine because his channel is so much more, it's so much bigger than mine. He's got so far more subscribers. And I remember thinking, God, you haven't really thought this through. you know, and by that metric, some tart who does makeup videos and has 15 million subscribers, her ideas must be better than Sargon's. It's just absurd. It's a silly thing to say. So anyway, but I wanted to move on to the topic we were talking about, how the center cannot hold. I think that's, I mean, do you want to say any more about that, just on that matter?
Well, I mean, even the YouTubers are taking their talking points from, well, this is what everybody says about Paul Joseph Watson, who's like the standard bearer of slightly edgy, pandering to the masses, but not going, you know, oh, whoa, there. He's not going crazy horse. But that's what they all do, and they pinch ideas from the dissident right, water them down, polish them, sanitize them, get them ready for the YouTube algorithm, and then they kind of pass them off as their own talking points. So in a way, the center has been completely and utterly cooked. And the on the left, they recognize it. They say it all of the time, that they're gateways. They never use the argument that they're holding the line. They always say, well, they're a gateway to the real far right. And they even like Hope Not Hate, I'll use the term alt-light in their report, which is, it's a kind of, you know, because they're real dicks, and you know because they understand it's a kind of snooty, shitty term. And so they're just total pricks, and they think, yeah, well, we didn't invent this term. I think Richard Spencer is, but who cares? We're going to use it because it's a shitty term. We know it'll get under their skin, so yeah, let's push it.
Yeah, I remember when it came around, it was like, just before NPI in 2016. I remember it at the peak of the alt-right sort of mania, must have been about September, round about then. 2016. That was when that term. Maybe I'm misremembering. I think that's when it came around. It's been with us for 3 years now. More than 3 years. 3.5 years, and they're still light. You know, that's the thing. It's the most amazing thing. And this is how you know that they're not really serious. They're not really ever going to do anything.
The kind of what I would regard as a centrist, who I genuinely dislike, is somebody like. There's two kinds. And I did a video called Stephen Fry and the Centrist Morphine Drip. And because
I despise Stephen Fry. I hate him.
And you'll get these debates like with Stephen Fry and Douglas Murray. And, you know, I'm trying to think of like a well-informed leftist, sort of a Noam Chomsky type. But these days it'll be a woman I've never heard of. And they're there, and it's like, this is the big one. We're not going to hold anything back. We're going to dig into this. This is going to be serious stuff. We're going to tackle these ideas. We're going to get into the meat. And then it'll be like, what are we going to do about Islamic fundamentalism? And you think, oh, no, fuck off. Not this again. And it's always the same few lines of patter. And what particularly boils me piss about Douglas Murray is that, and I know that I've said this on a video, I'm going to repeat it anyway, it's Christmas. Let's get the best banter out. It's when Douglas Murray will say, like, on the one hand, I'm worried, he'll say where he goes to a conference and it's like, the far right. What I notice now, and it didn't happen 4 years ago, is that I get questions. And I get questions about IQ differences. And it never used to be the case. And I can see that something is stirring, something is bubbling up, something sinister and scary is bubbling up. Be prepared for what comes, and then at 10 minutes,
you're imitating his way of voice. He says things slowly in order to a sense of drama, yeah. And dread, great gravitas,
like one of those kind of gay English thespians. And then 10 minutes later, so he's like, I'm scared of what I see. These questions that come at me at my conferences and my speeches, I'm scared of what it's all about. And then 10 minutes later, he'll say, yeah, well, it's strange how Europe died. I've just got this big book out called The Strange Death of Europe. Nobody understands it. Where that? How did it happen? What a big mystery it is. And you think, well, maybe if you'd taken on board some more radical ideas, Europe wouldn't even be dying. Useless, useless twat.
Absolutely. And this is something I've said before myself, that I don't want to attack Douglas Murray too much, but it really does boil me piss, to use your term, that he'll pretend that the death of Europe is somehow strange when we all know that it's not. I mean, you can understand it easily enough whenever you're fucking ready, you know. It's there's really nothing strange about it.
No, nothing at all. Not if you break the conditioning, Douglas, but he won't go there because, I mean, you know, does he or does he not know? I think he does. I don't know. That's a different discussion, and one we've kind of gone over a lot. I mean, one of the things I'll say, you know, the last couple of years in the wilderness for the dissident right is that we kind of dialed back a little bit on certain questions, where in 2015, 2016, it was like non-stop. It was just constant, that question, thrown in everybody's face all the time. And you had to get into it. You had to talk about it, or you're a total fag and you're a cook. And I think one of the things we achieved was like, yeah, okay, we did it. Yeah, like kind of everybody kind of gets it. We did, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much censorship. Like the horse bolted. It was a big effort. Well, good effort, lads. But you can kind of, I love a good dog whistle. A good dog whistle will get you very far these days, and it wouldn't in the past. You couldn't get away with a dog whistle in 2016. You had to be explicit. But now that everybody kind of gets it, you can dog whistle a bit, and it's which is lucky, because they're out. They're out for vengeance. They're out to hunt us down.
Mm. Yeah. Now, on the matter of Douglas Murray, one other thing I would say, and this is to do with his stuff about race and IQ, is, well, so what are you going to do, Douglas? I mean, what is your solution then? How are you going to stop Europe dying if the average IQ in Europe 10 years, 20 years from now is 90? Now, surely IQ does matter. And, you know, these people who bring it up are bringing it up for a fucking good reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and he doesn't have an answer. He sees that as what he means, what he's getting at, is that this it's what we got into at the start of the stream, where he sees that as being stepping outside of the liberal bubble. And I did a video on this as well, called "What If the Problem Is Classic Liberalism?" So from this perspective, the reason why, you know, these classic liberals, because that's what he is, the reason why they dislike sort of talk of IQ and differences, biological differences, and it's not something I even talk about much, the you know, the racial thing, but one of the problems that classic liberals have got with that is that if there is, because they have an a priori model of man as being kind of the same and kind of rational, and you from a different, which would have been a sort of Christian Englishness, you know, in the way of John Locke. So the model that it was built on was correct for England in, say, 1780. It isn't correct anymore if you're going to bring that into the multicultural globalized West. You have to start looking further afield at problems and differences which are innate, and liberalism isn't prepared for that because it was never designed. It's the same kind of feature flaw that Peter Thiel was crying about when they started constructing the algorithms for the globalized technocratic end of history. And they don't want to step outside of that, because it shows a flaw in their whole worldview, and from their perspective in Western civilization itself, because Western civilization and post-Enlightenment liberalism are one and the same in their mind, and that's the problem. And so what that means, if you follow this way of thought through, rather than break these ideals to save the core tenets of the West, which aren't actually Enlightenment liberalism, for Christ's sake, then they would, because if you did that, they would say that was the end of the West. Whereas from our perspective, it's like, we are now, like I said in my video, like Ben-Hur, we are chained onto the galley of liberalism, and either we cut the chains or we go down with the galley. And people like we here, people in the chat, want to cut the chains from liberalism. Douglas Murray's point of view, which is literally there in The Death of Europe, The Strange Death of Europe, is that on the one hand, he doesn't want to cut the chain because that would be the death of Europe, but to cut the chain would also be the death of the core values of Europe, so he can't do that either. So he just has to go down with the galley, and as he says in the book, enjoy the nice paintings that we once had on the way down.
For God's sake. I mean, that's just a creed of defeat, isn't it?
Yep. And that's the... I watched the speech for them, a more recent one as well, and that was kind of what got on me tits. It was basically, what's your... It was on his new book, The Madness of Crowds, and his kind of takeaway was that we should all just enjoy what we still have left while we have it.
What is that? Is that supposed to be an honourable defeat?
Yeah.
Well, like, I don't know. At least we stuck to our principles while we were destroyed. It was a success, guys.
Pop along to the Tate Gallery and look at some nice pictures. Look at a few constables while the SWAT police are descending on London with armed police and plastic shields are coming out and the CCTV cameras are everywhere, the grooming gangs are running rampant. Look at it. Look at a nice picture of Constable or Turner. Listen to a bit of Elgar and remember better days. Hey, Douglas, fuck off. I mean, really, that's pathetic.
It really is. I mean, I've got nothing against high culture, fine art and all that. I want to emphasize that because it's important to say that, but that attitude is completely gutless. I mean, there's no point valuing high culture if you're not prepared to defend it. It's just—it's actually extremely luxuried and pampered and irresponsible, that kind of attitude. Does he think that our ancestors would have had the same attitude? Because I don't think they would have. Really up until the last few decades, the last 50 years. Anything prior to that, no, they would not have taken this defeatist attitude.
And the thing is, like, it's an admission that they can't win. The solutions to the problems facing Europe, it can't happen within the liberal paradigm. If you've written a book called A Strange Death of Europe, you're pretty much admitting it. And that is the general point that he makes. That's it's like you can't save Europe while remaining within, broadly speaking, I'm not talking about the progressive, the broad liberal umbrella that we've lived in for hundreds of years, especially in England and Britain, that we can't do what needs to be done within that. And what I don't like about these people is that I think, well, then retire and piss off and let somebody else have a pop at it. Maybe we should step outside of liberalism then. What are you doing? You're just in the way, if that's your attitude.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's... I understand. I'm certainly not going to criticize anyone for getting depressed and getting depressed publicly, because God knows I've done it myself many times. But I think that if your creed really is just defeat, then that's definitely time to take a step back and just not participate in the conversation anymore, because all you can do is not only get people down with your demeanor, but even get people down with your advice. I mean, that's terrible. That really is irresponsible, I think.
Honorable defeat. And this is the thing as well. It's not like the ref's going to come in and just kind of blow the whistle and say, all right, lads, you had a fair innings, but we are going to you had a good game, lads, but we're going to give the game over to the third world and Islam, global homo and the LGBT propaganda and everything. You had a good go at it, but you lost. It's not going to work like that. It's going to be like a decades and decades and maybe even centuries long drawn out defeat and despair and misery.
Every painting and every sculpture and every building that you value and treasure as high culture, every single one of them is going to be shattered and ripped to shreds. That's what you're actually authorizing to happen when you select despair, defeat as an option.
If some sort of, let's just say, some new nationalist party popped up, and then they won, and then they just kicked aside democratic process. We're done with that. It's trash. It's a dictatorship, and we're going to start implementing policies that's going to sort this shit out. They're going to be quite brutal, but we will survive, and we will move on to a brighter tomorrow. Now, what constitutes Western civilization would actually survive in that. But for somebody, the liberals, the classic liberal pundits, that would be the end of Western civilization, because they view Western civilization and classic liberalism as being one and the same thing, and it isn't. It absolutely isn't.
Exactly. When they say that democracy is a key value, first of all, I don't think you should reduce a civilization or a culture, definitely not a people, to a set of values. I think that's a grave mistake. I'm still trying to get through to various people on that matter, but I just think it's a mistake. Hopefully I'll succeed in persuading various people of this. It's a mistake. But then when you say that the values in question, which you've selected as being representative and absolutely crucial to Britain, are ones that were not really even believed in until 100 years ago. You're really on pretty shaky ground at that point. You know, democracy is not a key, and I'm not even saying that it's right or wrong, good or bad. I'm just saying it's not key to Western civilization. It's definitely not key to British culture, British society.
No, not at all. In fact, you could even say that was the beginning. I like a bit of Oswald Spengler, and he would say that the Enlightenment was the beginning of the end. That was when it reached peak of the civilization phase, and everything became expansive, everything became materialistic and godless, and the metropolitan elite took over. This is it was all downhill from there. And where you end up is in this formless, as people call it this year, clown world, where everything goes, there's no coherent structure, there isn't even a concrete definition of what a man and a woman is. It's like watching the colours of the rainbow just all blurring into each other, where all structure and all form is deconstructed and decayed. That can be rectified. But you'll need a stern taskmaster. But I'd love to see that happen. I think it will be renewal. And I think, and by the way, you know, I mean, it's funny because last year when I came on, I was saying we were talking about the reactionary movement of going back a bit further, and I was saying I can see there being a kind of renaissance of the Catholic scene, and that's absolutely happened this year. And you can see where, confronted with this nihilism, this nothingness at the end of the which has been our theme of the end of history, there is nothing looking back at you but this abyss. And it makes perfect sense to me that people are going to go looking back in the past for forms of identity which give them strength and meaning, and then try and bring that forward into the future. That's been like the theme of the Gripers and everything this year, I would say. But in the case of somebody, what we're talking about, the centrists, they don't have that. They don't have anything to offer. They can't offer fresh pastures in the future because it's their whole ontology, their philosophy, which is played out, which is dead. And this is why they say, well, it's the end of Europe. No, it isn't. It's the end of a liberal Europe.
Yeah. And to tie this back to something, or maybe not tie it back to what we were saying at the start, do you think that this universe of nothing that liberalism seems to create, do you think that is the same universe as Thiel and his colleagues were talking about, this sort of hyper-rational universe Do you think that the end result of rationality is nothingness?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what's in the way? What would prevent that happening then? What's the thing that prevents us from getting to total nothingness?
Well, metaphysics in one form or another. And this is where I get attacked from the pagans all of the time, because I'll talk about Christianity quite a lot. But the fact is, what we think of as European man and what we think of as Western civilization, or you can't really get out of that without invoking Christianity as being the forming, as being the form which constructed it and offered a spine to it for the last 2,000 years. Now, you can say that's not an authentic manifestation of European spiritualism. That's a fair argument to make. I'm not against that, but we are where we are. We still have 2,000 years of Christianity, and what we see is that the forms, which might be, say, cathedrals and our art, were influenced by Christianity. You can't undo history that way. And I mean, one of the things that I do find interesting is that you'll see somebody seeing this resurgence of, say, the Groypas, and people's renewed interest in Catholicism, and they'll say something like, "Well, you can't go back, and you can't go back to 1950s America. It's impossible. You can't recreate that." And they're right, you can't. But what, say, progressives and you know, certain elites do recognize and really fear is that you can destroy modernity trying to do that. The yearning for a past that makes sense, where you have meaning, can be so strong that you can actually destroy the modern world just trying to make that manifest in the modern world. And I think there's a lot of people right to be very, very wary about that. But I've got to lighten it up a bit, but it wouldn't kind of materialize in the world as anybody thinks it would, because they'd be constantly having to stamp out the baggage of modernity and post-modernity. And I think it would be quite brutal. But, you know, there was like a report in the Independent yesterday where 19,000 English girls have been reported as being groomed in 2019. 19,000, that's 10 Rotherhams last year. And, I've had enough. I've had enough of all forms of liberalism. It's had its chance and it can go. And if something much more stern comes along, I'm not that picky. I'll live with it. I'll be happy with that.
Mm. To get back to the matter of, we're talking about the centrists and how they are lost. There's another thing that happened this year, or is in the process of happening now. We're sort of dialing it down a bit just now. Tommy Robinson.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the big story of the last few months. I mean, where do you want to go with that? I don't know what somebody contacted me on Twitter today and said, you know, he's been stitched up by Ezra Levant, and there was this really sort of complicated, convoluted argument, and I don't really care. And I said, yeah, look, mate, like, he's released videos kind of attacking my friends and allies. I'm not really in the mood to take much of an interest that he's getting a hard time of it from his own camp. Like, I don't really care. I don't know what this is. I don't really care. It leads onto some controversial territory, the Tommy Robinson one.
It does. But what I wanted to, well, the sort of angle that I was hoping to take on it was that the counter-jihad thing is no longer enough. Because that's what he represents. As much as he represents something else as well, ostensibly, he represents the endlessly moaning about Islam. And I wanted you to talk about that, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the like the libertarians, they've been caught out by this whole global homo woke capital thing, where people are beginning to understand. It's as if the Hegelian dialectic, the pincers are now finally beginning to close, and we can see what's truly in store for us. And it isn't that we're just going to be living under Sharia law. In fact, when you look at the absolute madness of the sexual perversions, there's a lot of people saying, I'll take the Sharia law, which isn't. Well, I mean, again, this comes back to what I was just saying, where you will take a more traditional, archaic form of the past and try and just bring it into the future.
But I was talking to a centrist recently, and he actually said to me, and I don't know if he was being how sarcastic he was being, because you never know how seriously they're taking anything. But he actually said, well, if it's Islam or trans kids, I'll take Islam.
Yeah, there'll be a lot. I'd prefer to take Catholicism or fascism, but it doesn't really matter, because at any rate, people are going to look for an escape from the absolute hell of the transgender issue, the LGBT marches, and what that represents. I mean, one of the things that I'll on the counter jihad, you know, we were talking about projections from the noughties, and when I was going through my counter jihad phase, Mark Stein had just released his book called America Alone. And that's kind of long forgotten now, you know, because there's a lot of new people in the movement.
It's surprising to remember sometimes that he's still around. He's got a YouTube channel, and I sometimes watch it. So you go. I don't want to.
America Alone was published, I think it was like 2004, and his prediction was that it was all about demographics, and it was basically that Europe is done. And America, in the future, the thesis was that in the future, America will be all alone, like the last bulwark of Western civilization. And he was an out-and-out neocon at the time. He's dialed it back a bit. He's more of a Trumpian now, but not much. You know, there's not much difference. But he was interesting to me is that his prediction was that by 2010-20, France would be living under Sharia law. Like, it would be a full lockdown.
Yeah, that's, you know, in 2010, that's really an ambitious thing to see. I wouldn't have projected that.
I think it was 2004, 2007 he published the book. So he was looking 13 years in the future. But basically it was like, yeah, it's happening. It's going to happen. It's faster than what you think. And you're all going to be living under Sharia law. And in actual fact, you don't actually see that taking place. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the Western liberalism and globalism and progressive values may well cook Islam, as they say.
And, well, I know that is the hope of some centrists.
Well, it gets you into a funny position, because I'd rather they, I've got to say it, it's the obvious, I'd rather they just weren't here. I'd rather they were living the pure Islamic life without Western interference back in their own homelands and all that. But I think when you look at what the counter-jihad, the neocons were saying, yeah, it hasn't really come to fruition. The alarm bells have been ringing for like 15 years. And when it came to that Birmingham thing, you will see that the globalism and progressivism didn't back down. You'll see somebody like the counter jihad types, like Fjordman, remember him, or maybe Douglas Murray, maybe not so much, Robert Spencer and the rest of them, and they're going to be like, yeah, well, Islam's just going to go to town. You'll see pictures here of Owen Jones, and they'll have done like a Photoshop, so it looks like he's being thrown off a building in Iran or something. In actual fact, the Muslim kids in the schools, they're getting the LGBT education as well. They are getting Netflix as well. they are getting the like being normalized to homosexuality on the television as well. And you begin to see that actually the real enemy is just starting to reveal himself, and it's where all religious, all traditions are going to be ground down into this massive consumerist pulp. Islam's just one of them. I wrote in a blog article a few years ago, and I kicked around the idea that one of the reasons for the Islamic immigration was because if you've got tens of millions of Muslims in Europe and they are all being liberalized, that will have a feedback loop on the main collective back in the Middle East. So you may well begin to see the rise of feminism across the Middle East as a sort of backwash of all of these Muslims in the West.
So that, and if we could actually manage remigration, we'd be sending back a bunch of sort of there's a word for this in science fiction. You'd be seeding liberalism, basically. Dormant. What's the word? Cells or something. You'd be sending them back to liberalize the Middle East.
Yeah, the imprint of Western liberalism would be there in the minds of all of these Westernized Muslims heading back to the Middle East to spread the virus.
That is a see again, because I do wonder if one of the goals, other people have said this, that one of the goals of mass immigration is just to induce a holy war between the West and Islam, so that leaves Israel okay. And so this would be part of that, actually, at a cultural level. You get the West to tame Islam, to neuter it, castrate it. Then it goes back, and then that becomes the Islam in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say that because the wars, the neocon wars of the 2000s, they were all about establishing supermarkets and Walmarts across the Middle East. And the places like Iraq, they bumped off all of the hard men who, they put them on this, they made the banks private, they took control of the money supply, and then they also absolutely flooded their TV channels with porn straight away. And so what they're doing, this is kind of E. Michael Jones things, and so what they're doing is introducing them into degeneracy and anti-traditionalism. And so, you mentioned about Israel. Let's look at it this way. Let's just say because it didn't really happen, although some people would say Iraq, that is actually happening. I don't know. You don't hear much about that part of the world anymore. But let's just sort of fast forward a bit and imagine that Europe is just this nondescript group of consumerism and hedonism, and that we don't even have sexual identities anymore, nothing. 10-year-old girls, you've already got puberty blockers, transitioning and all of that. If that also happens in the Middle East and Islam, there'll be a lot of holdouts that will be bloody because you'd get reactionaries against it. But yeah, you may well find that in the middle of all of this is one country and people left standing with their own identity, lording it over an endless ocean of consumer slaves.
Yeah. I mean, that is a very grim prospect. Very. I don't want to get people down too much, especially at the end of millennial, but I think these things do naturally come up in conversation, at least when it's me and Markov. So please forgive us. But yeah, it is a depressing notion. And I really don't know. I have no idea what is the plan here, or if there is any plan as such. I think in a way, sometimes I think they're just putting the pieces where they're likely to have a cumulative effect that is favourable to a certain group.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually. I'm quite optimistic. I'm not actually black-pilled, despite it all.
Well, let's talk in that direction then. I think that would be quite.
I, 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 enjoy the fight.
So do I. I'm not against this kind of conversation. I'm just conscious that I don't want to get people down at this time of year. I'd rather leave them with some white pills. It's worth saying, by the way, that we hit 2,100 viewers a few minutes ago. So I think that's probably a first for me. Thank you very much for everyone to everyone who's watching. So let's go in the one of the biggest white pills is having Morgoth and Woz chatting on Millennial. Thank you very much. It's very nice to say that. Yeah, we will be doing super chats. There are quite a lot of super chats. So don't worry about that. So if you want to, I'll post the link right now in case you want to send something to Morgoth. Here we go. There we are. So let's head in the white pill direction, Morgoth. Or do you want to do the, let's do the super chats now, and then we can do that towards the end. Okay. Fantastic work, Woz, and Morgoth is a very fitting end to 2019. Thank you very much. Are either of you religious in any way? I'm not, but I'm sort of I call myself a reluctant agnostic. I would like to be religious, but I just can't find a way to believe in God.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, but you know, I've taken some heat because of how amenable and friendly I've become towards, especially Catholicism. But I can't actually. I find that I can't do that because I can't get fully on board the Roosh V and E. Michael Jones train, because at a certain point in the future, I may have to support a certain party or a certain course of action, which may not be particularly it may not be in line with Christianity. And I've done quite a few videos on it, exploring the idea about morality, moral absolutes. And in this particular case, I'd love it if there was an objective good and evil. But in just to be purely pragmatic about some of the things that I have to endorse or support or may well do down the line, getting back to the Douglas Murray situation before, I can't, I don't want to sort of think to myself, I can't do this because I'm signed up to a religion. And in that way, I'm stuck forever in the material realm of just being pragmatic. So it's kind of sad, but that's where I am. My people come first.
I think that this actually is an interesting matter because you did a fantastic video a few months ago, maybe 4 or 5 months, like August, September time, August probably, about, and you made the point that we're actually up against evil. You know, you were talking about Epstein and so on. Rotherham, that kind of thing, and you said that it is actually a war, or you said perhaps it is a war against good, between good and evil. And then I gave a speech at the PA conference at the start of September where I sort of picked up on that. It hasn't been uploaded yet. It will be published soon after Millennial. It's called Elemental, and I said the same thing, that we seem to be battling something that historically has been called evil, a force called evil. And I think that brings it into, if not religious territory, then definitely into metaphysical and spiritual territory. You know, abstract forces, basically.
Yeah. Because we've been talking about this, because a lot of the sort of the counter jihad types, they will see Islam as being a manifestation of evil. And we kind of got into that a little bit just before there. What happens if that's wrong? What happens if evil is something different? What happens if evil is only just coming into view now? Now, this is where people will get bored if I go over it again, but a good way to, I found this just because these, a lot of people, this is new to them. And a good way to really easily sort of imbibe this is if you think of Lord of the Rings. In Lord of the Rings, there's a definite good, there's a definite evil, and what you find is that the drama and the action takes place in a grey zone. It's all about corruption. That's what it's all about. It's all about corruption, and the good or the evil trying to use what's in the middle as proxies to fight a war. If you go to something like Game of Thrones, which is postmodern, they've abolished those concepts and it's a free-for-all. And what you end up with is a sort of Nietzschean will to power, where there is no good, there is no bad, it's dog-eat-dog and everybody out for themselves. And so which of those two models is better describes the world that we're in today? It's a very interesting question to get into, I think.
Well, what's interesting about it from my point of view is that it elevates this struggle that we're in above the material. You know, it means that it's not just about money. It's not just about DNA. It's not even just about land. It's actually it's something abstract.
And I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that, let's say you have to make a decision which isn't, you have to support a certain policy, which isn't, you can't describe that in any way as being an act of good, but it is a will to power which it will have effects which are good, if you know what I mean, which it will force an outcome which is good and is necessary. But if you signed up to the position of that there is an absolute good, you couldn't go through with it. And so that's why I find myself stuck in this kind of will to power Game of Thrones world, even though I'll acknowledge that there's probably a greater struggle going on.
Right, I see what you're saying now. Okay, another super chat. Millennial 2019 was great. Thanks, Woz, and to Morgoth. You're always great.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Here's some oil money from Norway. Thanks for this year's Millennial. Best one so far. Let's all strive to stay white-pilled in the coming years. To win, we must think we will win, no matter the odds. I think that's simply true. You have to have the attitude that, you have to have a positive attitude and assume either we are going to win or we stand a bloody good chance of winning. Because if you approach this pessimistically, that will wear you down. And it's cumulative.
You begin to understand, just it's kind of related to the last question, because you begin to understand the power of having a higher belief outside of yourself. Because if you believe that you are fighting on the good of truth and beauty against evil and depravity and ugliness, then you've got some fire in your belly and a sense of righteousness, which is much more powerful than endless debates of the sort of IQ nationalism stuff, and you get bogged down in debates about DNA and all of that. That the what we're looking for is a narrative.
Precisely. And for those of us who don't have religion, finding a narrative is quite difficult. And this is why I was so heartened by your video a few months ago. It really sort of really changed things for me. And I don't know if I did it justice in the speech that I gave at the conference, Elemental, but I was, it seemed to go down quite well. But for me, it was a turning point. Again, that term has become rather sullied of late, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
All right. Tony Hares is the funniest thing since Les Dawson.
He'd love that. Who said that? Tony Hares.
I don't think so, no.
Ah, he's great. He's great, Tony. He's an old. He's been on my blog for years. There's still a little community on my blog, sort of chatting with each other. And great, great lad. Still there. Still going strong.
Okay. Morgoth, I like your wit and humour. Return to religion, is it due to already being in place and a big club? People will move towards it over manufactured chaos.
Yeah, well, I haven't returned to religion. I don't think that I can, but I do respect it, and I think it is absolutely something which can beat manufactured chaos because it gives a sense of purpose. And you can have an idealized form of the world, and then you can think, right now I want to bring that idealized vision into being in the world, which you can't if you're just bogged down in the material realm, because there's no guiding light.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could talk for ages on this matter. It's scary to be just, you know, a bunch of atoms with no meaning, no purpose. So it's, I've railed against nihilism throughout all of my channel's life. And prior to that, because it is this perennial danger. Yeah, and, you know, people still hold the bestiality thing against me. You know, I still get idiots bringing it up, claiming that I was advocating or defending bestiality. I wasn't. The whole point of it was that I was despairing at the fact that without a metaphysical or religious framework, it's difficult to say that anything is good or evil. And so, yeah.
I've seen you get, like, shit for that. And it was when I was about a year ago when I began to investigate these things a bit more. And I thought, and I actually understand where he's coming from. And yet that little clip is dragged out all of the time to make you look like a twat. But in actual fact, you're making a salient point that you can't just base morality on nothing or abstract laws, which is another bugbear, which I'm going to get into probably my next few videos.
I try to communicate as clearly as possible and not to use jargon words, not to use overly complicated sentences, whatever. I try to communicate very clearly. And yet still there are some concepts, some things I say that people misconstrue. And it's very frustrating because often they misconstrue it to mean exactly the opposite of what I meant. It's infuriating. Of course, sometimes you've got to assume that they're doing it deliberately. But anyway, that's my bugbear. We don't need to talk about it. I just want to make the point that this was the whole thing. Without religion, it's difficult to say that anything is right or wrong. And I think this is a massive problem. It's that nihilism leads to this, atheism leads to this, and that's why I wish we had some sort of framework. Okay,
what you have without an absolute good is the will to power. And when you've imbibed that, then you're going to have to think, well, what's happening to then it becomes a much more brutal and ugly world. And you're going to have power and you're going to have it fast. And until you do, you're just going to get the boot in your face. And you can't really complain about it. All you can do is look for ways to get power yourself. That's the way that system works.
Yeah. I mean, a resolution to this matter was finally presented to me by a Catholic commenter who on my channel who introduced me to the concept of telos. And I brought this into my Withnell speech in May 2017. And that is that, you know, any creature, any being, any object has a natural end, has a natural thing that it is built to fulfill, to achieve, to reach. And there is no way that you can say that bestiality leads man to his telos. There's just no way you can say that. Whereas you can say that normal sex does, work does, socializing does, eating healthily does, etc., etc. So that really sort of helped me because it provided a way out of this awful dilemma for me. But anyway, we really shouldn't be talking about that on this stream because it's not, well, it kind of, it's definitely relevant. It's definitely come in quite naturally, but I don't want to dwell on it for obvious reasons. It's kind of macabre. Okay, cheers for another great and very white-pilling millennial. I think the left really, really hates Morgoth because he absolutely shatters their archetype of a working-class gammon. Love you, lads. Thank you very much. That actually is an interesting opportunity for us to talk about something else that happened to you this year, Morgoth, which is that you attracted the ire of... Well, do you want to tell this story?
It's Billy Bragg and Morrissey story, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because Stormzy's been... the good, the Bragg, and the Stormzy. Yeah, I think do I need to roll it out like a Christmas special story? But I basically at the Glastonbury pop concert, Stormzy did this. He headlined it, and then everybody came out and was saying like he's the second coming of Elvis. He's the funniest thing I've ever seen him. It was just amazing. He was like God, and I just sort of trashed it. You know, when back in the 90s, you know, when I was a young chap, Michael Jackson appeared on stage at the Brit Awards, and he came on like Jesus, and it was so pompous and ridiculous. And Jarvis Cocker, who is himself a lefty twat, jumped up on the stage and sort of wriggled his arse. And it was this particular sort of British way of bursting this big pompous balloon, this pretentious act that was on, you know. And that's really all I did with the Stormzy performance. It was like a 7-minute video, and I just said, it's bullshit. The establishment love him. He's never pushed out a door that wasn't opened for him by the establishment. And Morrissey posted it on his website. And then Billy Bragg and all of the, it wasn't just Billy Bragg, it was NME. Remember NME, the New Music?
New Musical Express, wasn't it?
And they were like, oh, Morrissey's supporting white supremacists and neo-Nazis and everything. And it was just such a hullabaloo. I couldn't believe it. I kind of buckled under the pressure because YouTube censorship was going on. I thought this is really hot to have on the YouTube. I put it on BitChute. And then I did a follow-up video, which is still on. And Billy Bragg in particular came out, who's this like lefty wanker and hope not hate supporter, and like a complete champagne socialist. He's from Barking, and when it got multicultural, he moved to a mansion in Dorset, which is all white, but then he continued to attack the BNP.
I mean, Lily Allen did it as well. She lives in the fucking Cotswolds.
And so, and I made a response to Billy Bragg. And the funny thing is, like, what I said was basically what happened with the Labour wall. And I said, like, because his ideology would be that I'm in the position, I'm a forklift driver in a warehouse, I said to Billy Bragg, and you're gonna whinge that I'm bullying like somebody who's in a position of weakness when he's a multimillionaire and gets the headline gigs everywhere? You're fucking kidding me, you prick.
Of course, I find this very interesting because he is, as you said, not only well, he's a supporter of Hope Not Hate, as you said, but he's actually a bit, I mean, there's clearly some, they're friends, I think you could say. I don't know if there's a formal association between Billy Bragg and Hope Not Hate, but you see him on Twitter retweeting their stuff and all this. And it interests me because, I mean, it's hilarious how you sort of bumbled into this in your inimitable way. You bumbled into this and suddenly you had all these like Billy Bragg, Stormzy, Morrissey, Hope Not Hate, all of these different things ranged against, well, not Morrissey, obviously, he was in support of you, but it was hilarious and I really admired that you had done this. Like I thought, oh wow, you know, it's like this big controversy triggered really by accident. I mean, you couldn't possibly have known that was going to be the effect when you made that video. But it does, it's this interesting thing because Hope Not Hate, Billy Bragg is a champagne socialist who got rich in industry, in capitalism. And now he lives in a mansion. He's friends with Hope Not Hate, who are, for want of a better word, cultural Marxists, globalists, in league with big business and the Labour Party, and Stormzy is a product of major capitalism, and they're all having a go at this working class guy. I mean, the irony is just incredible.
I'm like the white oppressor, and then when I posted I was outside, I was at work, and I was sitting outside, and I was like, I'll change his name. Let's just call him Jimmy. And I don't take a phone to work. I'm total retard with technology. Well, anyway, and we had our dinner. I says, how are you? Pull your iPhone out. Let's see how me Billy Bragg video is doing. So then I'm looking at how my video is doing on his, the evil oppressor who's bullying this poor little black boy from inner city London, who's the scourge of like the champagne socialist, the anti-racist elite from Croydon and from Chelsea and Dorset. And there I am sitting outside of a warehouse well, little Jimmy, get on your phone. Let's see how many hits I've got on my video then. And it's just this complete ridiculous inversion of reality. And the key to this, and what I put to Billy Bragg, is that who here is in the position of power? Who you were punching down here, you dumb prick.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I thought it was an interesting moment. Really one of my favourite moments in the history of this movement, this community. I thought it was wonderful.
So, Morrissey was so aloof from the whole thing. Like, there was no apologies or anything. And on the Billy Bragg, because I did two. I did the Stormzy one, which got us in all of the trouble. And then I did a follow-up, which was a response to Billy Bragg in particular, telling Billy Bragg what I thought of him. And we Thurbitton got like did a brilliant guitar intro, and we used like a really classic Smiths tune, which was like really catchy. And I thought that was such a nice touch to intro the music, to bring it on with. But in Morrissey Central, where it was posted, it said blue skies for Stormzy, unpersoning for Morrissey. That's how they headlined it and then put my video as the main article. And it was true because, you know, it's already well, you know, playing working class hero and everything. But the fact is, like, Morrissey is a legend, and he has been unpersoned because what the core of it was is who is speaking truth to power here. That's what it all come down to at the end of the day. It wasn't because I'm a white supremacist or anything like that. It was because I call the Billy Bragg and Stormzy and the establishment, the independent and MMA out as being bullshitters who were the establishment. And me and Morrissey were saying, well, we are the anti-establishment here and you can't stand it.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one time on Twitter, when I was on there in my real guise, and I posted something and added Laurie Penny in it, just randomly. It's nothing to do with, I thought it'd be interesting to see what she would say. And it was like one of my videos, or somebody in the movement had done a video, and I was interested to wonder what Laurie Penny would say if she was confronted with this video. So I did that, and she replied, "What even is this?" And I replied, "It's counterculture, Laurie." And I thought, that's a really funny interaction there, because it's like this girl who is completely part of the establishment and yet thinks that she is countercultural is actually presented with counterculture. And her only response is, "What even is this?" She doesn't even know. She doesn't recognize it. And I think it was the same mentality, but in a more conscious form, with you when you went up against this massive thing that happened between all like Billy Bragg, Hope Not Hate, the Independent, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I said it to Billy Bragg. I've got a fucking YouTube channel with 10,000 subs at the time. Stormzy's got the headline gig at Glastonbury. Who is the establishment here, you prick?
Exactly, exactly. All right. So I will move on to the next super chat, unless there's anything else you want to say about that, because it was a really interesting thing. Now, someone's asking, why am I wearing a towel? I'm not wearing a towel. It's a shawl. It's like a blanket thing. It's really good. Very comfortable.
No, I've said everything about the Billy Braggs, the Morrissey, Stormzy drama. I've played it out.
Okay, okay. Somebody's in the chat saying, I won't read that out, but yeah, okay. All right. Okay, if the new Islamic immigrants are going to be sent back to the Middle East to seed liberalism, how would that square with the idea that culture is downstream from race? I think it simply would, because it doesn't really matter. They would have been given a culture that did not come from them, from their race, but it would have been implanted in them by being here in this country. And of course, it doesn't matter whether they fully understand that culture. It doesn't matter that they didn't create it. The fact is, they can still adhere to it. They can still buy its bullshit, buy its values, and so on, and then take it back there.
I mean, from a real traditionalist sort of Julius Evola perspective, they would say that Islam is already cooked. They've got satellite dishes on the side of the houses. They drive around in cars. They already do have the imprint of modernity on their minds. So that's a deep black pill. But what you would see if that took root in the Islamic world, which is what you already see, this is where you would get these reactionaries trying to purge the Ummah of outside influences, corrupting influences, which is like pretty much the story of the Islamic world over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, someone says, thanks for a memorable millennial. Thank you very much. Somebody else says, some extra cash for a great millennial. Happy new decade to you both. Thank you very much, Charlemagne. Okay, as the dissident right is almost shunted into an alt-tech ghetto, shouldn't we be prioritising strategies for diplomacy and wooing the centre-right and the white working class to come our way with pipeline accounts? I don't know what pipeline accounts means, but basically saying if we're going to be ghettoised in alt-tech, BitChute, Gab and so on, then shouldn't we be trying to reach out to the centre-right? What do you think, Morgoth?
I think that's all right. Yeah, I think that'll happen. I think what would happen if we were completely ghettoised, I don't view that as badly as some people do. But if you assume that the sites don't just get taken down, which is a possibility, they would act as a sort of stronghold where we can flesh out our ideas and do our thing, and then from there, people go out across the wider, not just the internet, but into the real world as well, having a formal established. Basically, what would be forced to do would be to establish a stronghold and a beachhead, and then carry out operations from there. Where we are now is that we're kind of on flimsy ground. I mean, there's an argument to be made that let's just do it, just kill us off entirely, and we'll get it over and done with, and move on from there. Because as it stands on this platform, everybody's watching what they say and everybody's tripping over certain words.
But let me just interject there, because a few months ago I was showing a video of mine, an old video of mine, to a friend, and it was the one that I made immediately after getting doxxed. And it was the 2-minute one, The Tortures of the Doxed. It was a 2-minute sort of animation with, you know, quite cool music and all that. I was very, very proud of it. And I can't remember why I was showing it to this friend, but it doesn't matter now. The point is that while watching it, I noticed that my wording, this was January 2017, and I noticed that my wording was, it said something like, it was addressing the mainstream media, and it said, enjoy being replaced by alternative media. And at that point, I was referring not to things like BitChute or Gab, but to YouTube and Twitter. And of course, a year and a half later, or a year and 9 months later, I got banned from Twitter. And now we're all terrified of being banned from YouTube. Well, I'm not terrified anymore. I'm sort of resigned to it now. I'm just waiting for it to happen. I'm assuming it's basically already happened. But this is the point. Back in January 2017, the idea of being banned from YouTube just didn't occur to anyone. And so we did assume that it was our beachhead, that it was our stronghold from which we could interact with the world at large. And I think that that idea has been completely gone away now. You know, in 2018 and especially 2019 with the various purges. And again, I'm not going to be black-pilled or defeatist about this. As far as I'm concerned, I don't really have 56,000 subscribers. I have, you know, 5,000 subscribers on BitChute, and those are the ones who are going to be with me, you know, a year from now. Hopefully it will grow, of course. But I'm just saying I no longer think about this, that the YouTube channel is just, it's something I happen to have. I cannot afford to be emotionally attached to it. I cannot afford to take pride in it, really, because I know it could be destroyed at any moment.
I mean, my general take on this is that the censors, and we know who's doing it at the end of the day. We can wax lyrical about the Peter Thiel and you know, the meta and all of that. But I think we know who's doing this, but I also think they're too late.
Yeah, I agree.
I do think 2015, 2016, 2017, there were so many red pills and the content was so hardcore, so hard-hitting that you can kind of dial it back a bit now. It's as if to say we can say, yeah, because you can get away with a few hints and a few coded words, which is why I think it kind of halted. And they think, well, what do we do now? Because we know this is why some of the channels which get deleted, it's because they want to say, well, this is hate speech, but it isn't. It isn't. But they are. But they are kind of nodding and winking in that direction. Can we just take them down blatantly? And they do, of course, they do. But it is difficult for them because. Is we were talking about these big nerd channels, is Critical Drinker nodding and winking in a certain direction? Well, to be honest, yes.
I don't want to endanger him by agreeing. I mean, I don't think that he's consciously doing that, but I think that he has imbibed, like many of them, they've imbibed something off the alt-right of 2016. Yeah.
And nobody who watches, this is the thing, what they're doing is kind of inoculating the masses to political correctness. So when they're confronted with more hardcore ideas, they don't really care. It didn't used to, I mean, you'd go back to 2015 and 2014, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, and this is why I think we should perhaps try to adopt a more conciliatory attitude towards the, you know, the centrists and so on, because they are actually in their cocked way, they are red pilling people against the progressivism and all that. And now we can complain about the degree to which they're doing that, but I think that the fact that they are doing it, and I think that what we should attack them for is for counter signaling and attacking us.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick point which always makes me chuckle is that on the one hand, they claim that there's no you-know-who question. On the other hand, they know exactly what words they can and can't say on YouTube.
Yes.
Or Twitter, or wherever it happens to be. So on the one hand, they have to think, well, this is all just like alt-right crazy conspiracy. We know what they're like. It's all Nazi stuff. And then at the same time, it's like, yeah, well, I'm going to have to phrase this carefully. I'm going to have to phrase this carefully because I'll lose my channel if I don't. And then when they do that, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of proving that we're correct.
Absolutely. And the most hilarious thing is when they'll openly say on YouTube that, you know, the Chi-Coms are censoring YouTube.
That
kind of says it all, doesn't it? I mean, if you're prepared to say that openly on YouTube, that means you don't really believe it, because otherwise you'd expect to lose your damn channel, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So I want to finish the point about, so you were talking about a beachhead, and I think that we used to think that YouTube was the beachhead. Clearly it is not. And I think that we will have, as I've said in previous millennials, I think we'll have a new beachhead on the likes of BitChute. And I think that isn't the end of the world, and it mustn't be the end of the world. after Red Ice were banned from YouTube, I made a video. I wrote a video script. It was a very affectionate script about Henrik and Lana, and I regret that I didn't put it up. It was partly because, well, it was mostly because I had the flu, and I was really just, I sounded awful, and I thought, if I record this voiceover, it's going to sound ridiculous and depressing when I don't want it to, because I'm ill, but I don't want it to sound ridiculous, so I didn't make this video. But the point I was going to make was, it's in our hands whether their banning weakens them, and to at least a great extent, it's in our hands, because we are the ones who decide whether Red Ice will have an audience in the future or not by deciding whether to subscribe to them on other platforms or not. In other words, when YouTube do this to us or Twitter do this to us, that person, that figure, that creator is still available elsewhere. It's up to us to adapt and go to them in their new place. And I'm hoping that BitChute will become a more inviting place for people to go, to actually spend their time. Because right now, I don't think it is, quite frankly. And
there's some issues here with copyright, I've heard. But you know what's great about BitChute is that there's channels and they do nothing except upload great movies. Really great. One of them's called Mellow Belly, I think. And there's something Ratnik Fick or something like that. But the point here, and I, like I said, I don't know how this works with copyright, but they're doing it and they've been doing it for a long time. But what this does is flesh out BitChute with really good, high-quality content, which makes people go there. So
I wouldn't want to recommend BitChute on that basis, though, because that's clearly something that they're going to have to eliminate. I mean, that's copyright violation. So I would imagine that that will not last. I think the future of BitChute has to be as the center for dissident content, and not just of the right. I mean, the left as well. Sorry to interrupt you there. If you want to go on.
Like I say, I don't know how it works with content, but the point is there's quality stuff on there which isn't politically orientated. And so I've got my mate watching whole channels of movies on there. But it is, yeah, that is a bit dicey with a copyright.
I'd expect they'll get rid of that. But the point is that I think it's going to become the new heart of things. And I think it will be better because we will be able to speak freely there. And for now, I think, and I'm in this transitional phase where someone said I no longer care about my channel on YouTube. I do still care about it. I'm just emotionally detaching from it because I don't want to be, I mean, you saw what it was like when I lost Twitter. It was devastating. And, you know, so I don't want to repeat that. So I cannot afford to think of my YouTube channel as something intrinsic to me anymore, because, you know, it's clearly not.
It's interesting because the far right, let's say, the dissident right, the alt right, our thing, as people have this the new branding now, our thing came quite late to YouTube. When I go back a few years, and for us it was all websites and blogs. And it was much more academic and philosophical, and that didn't lend itself to YouTube. You were one of the first on YouTube for a long time. You were pretty much just you, especially in the British scene. But because all of our people were, including me, were writing and not actually going on YouTube, and so we came very late to YouTube. And the interesting thing about BitChute is that it's kind of like a fresh start for everybody. And I can upload a BitChute video which won't go on YouTube because it'll be a little bit spicy, and it'll get more views than a Stefan Molyneux video, which is really interesting, because you think of these old sort of giants of YouTube are now having to restart on a different platform, and everybody starts off with nothing, where everybody has to redo everything all over again. And I think a lot of people are going to be in for a shock if this really goes on like that. How will a centrist video stand up against a good alt-right video on a free speech platform?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We'll have to wait and see how it goes. I mean, a lot of them will arrive there in the first place with a lot of subscribers from YouTube. A lot of their subscribers follow them over there, so they will have that as a beginning thing. But from that point on, it might well be that they'll find that actually on a level playing field, their ideas are not more popular. It would be interesting. All right, so we'll move on to the questions. Again, this is the last chance, because we've been going on for 2.5 hours nearly, so I think more people will be getting tired. So I'll just post the link for the last time. If you've got questions that you'd like to post, do so now, please. All right. Any books you particularly recommend?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would go for something quite normie, actually. Fallen Decline of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon is a good book. And I would also say Spengler's Fallen Decline of the West to sort of juxtapose against it as well. I'm not sure if that is Normie, actually.
No, probably not.
Well, I'll tell you a great novelist who is underrated, and he is kind of dissident right, would be Tom Wolfe. Years ago, when I went to Holland, there was a book just came out, and it was called A Man in Full. And so this is like 2000, and it was about identity politics. It was about the modern state of America, and this old bear, who was Charlie Crockeye was called, and it was about, he was like a multi-millionaire, but he was like swimming in debt, and it ended up where he had to get involved with the identity politics. There was a rape scandal, and you had race in it, and there's a lot going on which is very based in that. The people that he's trying to make a business deal with, because he's kind of anti-Semitic, and there's a Tom Wolfe Bonfire of the Vanities as well. I think in dissident right circles, Tom Wolfe is really underrated, and people will get a lot out of his stuff.
Yeah. The only thing I've read by him is an essay, which actually came up in one of the first millennials this year, The Great Relearning. And I did a reading of it. I think it was actually the very first Wednesday reading that I did back in the day, 2014. I used to do those readings of articles that I liked, and that was one of them. It was fascinating, The Great Relearning, but I won't go into it here because it would be a tangent. Okay, can Morgoth do more Archetypes of the Left videos?
Yes, I can, and I will.
Okay, good. I enjoy those. Has the Western, here's a big question, has the Western man fallen because he is too comfortable and tolerant?
Yes, tolerance comes from the comfort, I think. The deep dive on that is not just where you think it is and which group has corrupted us. I think the corruptors come in when you're already weak. And the march, why it's become, you can see that as technology has advanced, all technology, this is a reactionary take because I think people aren't used to it, so I'm trying to be original. But the reactionary take would be that technology always goes in the direction of making things easier and more comfortable and more amenable to people. And the more comfortable you become because of the technology, the softer you become. And this is clearly the case with Faustian Western Man, where more beyond that, where we've become entombed in our own economic and technological creation. But there are ways out of that. It isn't the end.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's exactly, I would make that point as well, that nothing is the end unless we all collectively decide that, unless we get defeated. And and then it's the end. But as long as there is life, there is a way forward.
What we're facing now is the equivalent of the winter seasons 4,000 years ago, or the Great Plague. We got through them. We're going to get through this. But first, we have to understand the true nature of the this.
Yes, yes, which surprisingly enough is actually quite difficult. All right. Do you believe controlled opposition exists within our cause?
It does, but in our circles, not so much. It exists on our left periphery. Where the grifters and the dodgy dealers and the bullshit have started, within sort of what people would think of today as the dissident right or white nationalism, broadly speaking, because you've also got the Catholic contingent. I don't actually think it does. I think it's a lot more peaceful than what it has been for a long time.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are. It's not so much controlled opposition, but the problem is personality issues within the movement. That's a problem. And I think there are some badly intentioned people, not many, but a few. So I think that's the problem more than controlled opposition as such.
I would say just because somebody's a prima donna doesn't mean they're controlled opposition working for the feds.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, what do I do speaking with my friends about reality, but all they care about is footy, rap music, etc., pop culture?
Point out how shit it is. Point out how crap what they're consuming is. In other words, what you do is make them aware of the their situation and what it is they're consuming. Make them conscious of it so that they start, that they're on the outside of it and then looking in. I've done that with the radio station at work, which I should do a video on that at some point.
All right. Someone says, thanks for another great millennial, Woz. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, what are Morgoth's thoughts on reforming traditional social ecological systems in the UK in order to conserve both natural and cultural heritage? Can this be used as another argument for nationalism? First of all, I think it can be. Yeah, so you go ahead.
It absolutely can be, and I did. I've got a video on my channel called the, which riffs on Corbyn's plan of the 12 billion tree project. I posted a few weeks ago, but what you have to do is sort of reframe this so that Corbyn talks about 12 billion trees or whatever it was, we need to plant like 10 billion trees in Britain. And what we should be thinking of is in terms of let's reforest the land.
Yeah.
And that's a big distinction. It's important.
Well, go into that distinction.
Well, one views the trees as just a standing reserve, as just a quantity. But when then you say, well, it isn't a billion trees, it's a forest and it's part of the landscape, it's actually a completely different thing.
Yes, it introduces a sense of romance into it.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of physics.
Yeah. Okay. Has Morgoth ever been disturbed by Prevent or such types?
No. I'm too old to get Prevent at my door. But I don't know what they'd say. The first thing is I'm not doxxed yet. But then I don't really know what they'd say to me because some of my blog stuff, we go back a few years, some of the articles on the blog were quite spicy and quite hardcore. Well, then I've become a little bit more nuanced, a bit more philosophical, because there's only so much you can sort of rail against the new you-know-whos and all of that. And I thought, what's beyond that? So if they get me, or if I get a knock at the door, it'll be for something that I've written a long time ago.
Yeah, that would be a really sort of slow-motion conversation, wouldn't it? I mean, I can't imagine them being terribly animated about that.
Yeah. But, you know, you do hear things.
Mm-hmm. You do. What do you guys think of the royal family in 2019? And do you think they will survive the coming decades? I think they will, but they're probably going to become increasingly lightweight and sort of pop culture-y. I think you can see that with Meghan Markle. I don't... Well, you go for it, Morgoth.
I don't care. I'm not invested in the royal family whatsoever. You know, if they were these sort of bastions of some sort of old British imperialism, and they let out some sort of conservative comments here and there, but because that's what people used to think. People used to think, well, what are they going to do about the royal family? They'll eventually wake up and see what's becoming of their reign and their country, their kingdom, their subjects. And it turns out they just don't give a shit. And so I don't really give a shit about them either.
Yeah, that's kind of my reluctant attitude now as well. I think that if they ever were connected to the people, connected to the country, well, they're not anymore. And so they're kind of useless at this point. I don't really know what it is that they're supposed to represent. So, okay, if you and Morgoth, and as for whether they're going to survive, I think they probably will, but I think they'll probably just be a joke by the end of it.
They'll become just this family that people will just forget about it, and they'll forget about it in the same way. I mean, I think even Germany may have like some sort of royalty kicking around there somewhere. Or there's countries in Europe who have this what used to be the royal family. Officially, it's the Still bloodline. They've got a nice mansion somewhere, but they go cycling down the streets and nobody cares. There's no pomp and ceremony whatsoever. I think that's where the British royal family will go.
Yeah. And I don't like it. I mean, I'm up for this. I like monarchy. I like aristocracy, but I like one that actually works and serves a function and looks after the common folk. And I think that as it stands, the royal family today just seem utterly disconnected and irrelevant. I don't really know what anyone sees in them anymore. Okay, if you and Morgoth could name one thing that would solve all or most of the problems in today's world, what would it be? You take it. I can't think of anything.
I think some sort of spiritual epiphany.
Yes. Well, that's a lofty goal. I would say probably an economic crisis, like a massive economic crisis. It would probably be the thing that would solve, that would begin, you know, that begin the process of healing. But it would really have to, if you're going to name one thing, then that's the thing that I would suggest. It's not that I want it, and it's not that I think it would be a complete solution. It's not nice, but there you go. I think that comfort, as someone else said earlier, a questioner, comfort is the thing that enables all of this to continue. So there we go. Yeah, okay. All right. Oh, here's an interesting question. In a society where all important issues were decided by referendum, would the increased responsibility lead to a more informed population?
Yeah, I think it would. I think it would. They'd have to, because it would be a constant sort of where you the whole way the society functions could change quite drastically quite often. I think that's why the elites don't like it. It's not just, you know, that it's going to mess up their master plans, but just on a basic functioning level. How do you propose the referendum? What does it decide? And it can lead to very drastic changes very quickly.
Yeah. Yes. I would also say I don't think it would necessarily lead to a more informed population, because, I mean, how many people on either side were really informed very much about the Brexit referendum? I think that people, it's one of those things where feelings don't care about your facts. I think that people don't really vote on the basis of facts, especially when it comes to a single issue where it's quite emotive. So I don't think it would lead to a more informed population, but I think it would lead to, I would like it. I would like far more referendums, because I think it would lead to the more political change. I think we desperately need to break the hold that the political parties have on the British populace and on the British culture. So, all right. What do you think of Alistair Williams? I think it's a comedian. His Brexit bit was brilliant, and he's had little work since. I could see him coming to the... I don't know. Have you heard of Alistair Williams, Morgoth?
No, I don't know who he is.
Right, okay. All right. Someone's asking if you could sing a bit of Run for Home by Lindisfarne, which is...
No, I'm not. I'm not going to do it. I posted that on Twitter. I love the song. It's I know who... I posted that. I said, this is the best Geordie song. This is my favourite Geordie song. But I'm not going to sing it.
Okay. Can you get him to say Shower of Bastards, but in your accent?
Shower of Bastards.
Okay. Okay. How's the fishing going, Morgoth? I started last year after watching your videos, and now I'm hooked. Nice pun there.
It's going shite. The fishing's going shite. I've actually haven't been for a while. I went in the summer quite a bit. I got a couple of bait, but I'm not the best fisherman. I actually spend more time rabbiting with the dog now than I do going fishing. But the thing is, we're in the North Sea, the cod come in the winter, and it's freezing cold, and so you've got more chance of catching a cod, you go down, you put some bacon or a bit of mackerel on and you bathe. The problem is you freeze your balls off for like hours and hours and you've got, and like there's no daylight. And yeah, it's a bit, I know like it's a bit of, I sound like a bit of a fanny, but I do actually prefer to like go down in my shorts in the summer and kind of get a suntan and have a bit of a mess around. But in what I've been doing a lot recently is rabbiting with the dog.
Right.
And she actually does get rabbits. So right. Fishing doesn't go that way. I got a flatty. In spring or something like that, but it's not great. It's not very impressive, lads.
I had this mental image of you on like trying to fish and you're freezing your balls off and you're just ranting to yourself about the money power.
I do. I've got a video. The last time I went fishing, I did a video and I was looking out across the. I wasn't at my usual spot and I'd put the phone on. And I was just looking out across the horizon and I kind of waxed lyrical for about 7 minutes about like the horizon and sort of the Faustian man and the English experience where it was, if you were an Englishman, that was kind of all you had was this huge expanse of nothingness. And I think there's something in the which gets back to people like Locke and the eternal Anglo thing, where it was very individualistic, and you can kind of see why if you've got this endless nothingness on the horizon, which is different from a landlocked country from Germany, because we didn't have if you're on an island, you don't have that really very many threats. Coming in, we did, of course, you got the Vikings and the Normans and stuff, but if you think of it from the German perspective, where they're constantly surrounded by these vast land armies, and you can kind of understand the effect that has on psychology, where they did become very internal and very introspective and to sort of collective with on their own land, which led to they got people like Hegel and Heidegger and all of these idealists, and we got people like Locke and all of these individualists, because they didn't have to collectivize on an island. And I kind of blathered on a bit, and I've got a video on the channel, but I didn't make it public. It was like my emergency video, and I told Theverton, like, you know, if something happens, then you can post that video and it'll... It's there for a rainy day.
All right, okay. All right, got a few more questions, maybe about 10, I think. What did you guys think about the Gherkin? I know this is the building in London. I know it's some modernist monstrosity in the middle of London, but I've always liked the building for some reason. I don't like it, sorry. Do you know the Gherkin, Morgoth?
Yeah, I don't like it either. It's, yeah, I can go on about the archaeology as well. It's getting there. The kind of postmodern sort of neoliberal architecture. It's all this sort of. It's all like the cars that we talked about before. It's all very soft. It's all glass and see through, as if it's got no soul. But it's welcoming at the same time. And I think there's something deceitful about it, because what's actually going on in there is quite destructive and quite sinister, what these kind of buildings do on the inside, on the computers and in the paperwork.
Well, that's often the way, isn't it? It's something that is made to look and sound sort of cuddly and nice, wishy-washy, but it's like the velvet glove around the iron fist. You know, inside it's fucking vicious.
Yeah, I mean, if Britain's Centre of Diversity and Social Justice Commission was in Battersea Power Station as it used to look, this huge, gigantic, sinister-looking video, it's on the film, it's on Pink Floyd's Animals video, which is famous with a pig, then you could, at least it's a sinister building, you know? But what happens in like today is that everything's soft and feminized. But what they're actually doing is really sinister.
This really came to the fore in the New Labour era, I think, when they would cloak something authoritarian in a nasty way, something, you know, something progressive and nihilistic and cruel and that kind of thing. But they'd cloak it in the language and the aesthetics that make you think, oh, this is kind of cozy, this is harmless, this is benign. But no, it's hardcore Blairite shittiness. All right. I won't ask that question. It's a bit too hardcore. Okay. Someone's asked. Okay. Okay, that's about some question about geopolitics that I'm going to skip because I don't think it's a bit late in the stream for that kind of stuff. Okay, would Morgoth ever consider participating in a blood sport style debate?
It depends who against and for what. I mean, I'm not trained to have some bloke speak to us like a dick on a stream for 3 hours. I would really lose my temper. That's not my background, and I'm not. I don't have the mentality for that. But who knows? We'll see.
All right. Will Russia become important in the 2010s? Telegram and their resettlement of South African farmers. Telegram is a Russian company,
and they're gonna what? So resettle South African farmers in Russia?
Yeah, there was a thing a few months ago where I think it actually ended up with the West accusing Russia of being racist for being happy to accommodate white South African farmers. Yes, there was a drive a few months ago in Russia for, they said South African farmers can go over there, like thousands of them.
I can see them do it. Well, just from a tactical perspective, I can see them doing that because they are aware of how crippled the West is with the anti-white identity politics, and that would be that would be a clever move. And it's not just that the Russians are particularly soft and liberal or anything, or particularly pro-white. Just as a sort of fuck you to the West and their anti-white politics, which the Russians know dominates, they would seed a narrative in the West which would be really easily done as well, which would create havoc in the West. The debate that would create would be very good, very interesting, and I think they'd like to sit back and sip their little vodkas and watch it play out.
Actually watch us go mad over a real Russia narrative for once. Yeah. That's the interesting thing. Well, we could go into that. Nah, let's not go into that. It does interest me, though, the Russia narrative, because it was invented. And, you know, there is the possibility that in the future it could actually come true, but entirely separately from, you know, Donald Trump and all that. So, okay. Right. So we'll move on now to the final question. Oh, but someone's just posted a new super chat. Great show, best this year. Millennial Woes, will you get the new keyboard synth? I don't know. I was talking about the Hydra synth, which I would really like. I'm not sure. I'll have to look at how much money has been made, and also my ongoing financial situation, in which regard people can help out if they want by help him out on Subscribestar. There's the link right now. Morgoth, did you get anything nice for Christmas?
I got socks and undies, the same as I get every year. That's it.
All right, okay. Any sock accounts? Sorry. Okay, so the final three questions relate to the same issue, which is what we were going to end on anyway. So what are your predictions for the following decade? And is Morgoth feeling white-pilled or black-pilled about the upcoming 2020s decade?
Okay, which one's first?
Well, just you can take them all at once. So what do you predict for the next decade? And are you optimistic or pessimistic about it?
I'm optimistic. I like it. I like the influence that we have, and I like the turmoil of the centre. I think we're going to be within 18 months, we are going to be in a war with the Conservative Party in the centre-right in earnest, because the left they've got cultural power but not political power. It's just more battles to be won, more narratives to overturn, and I'm looking forward to it. It's great. I mean, it's, I reminded of the, I think it's from General Patton on that movie Patton, when they say, you know, let's just assume that we didn't do this. Let's just assume that none of us were interested in this stuff, and we weren't paying attention to culture and politics. And then you would just sit and vegetate in front of whatever crap was on the television. And he has this great line where he says, you know, at the end of the day, you may not like the war, but it's better than shoveling shit in Kansas. And it's kind of true, because I'd rather be having these battles and exploring all of these ideas and seeing a change and seeing things materialize in the real world, than just doing nothing. I'm happy that I'm red-pilled, and everybody else should be, and because it's a little expression of power that you have, and that's how I look at it, and it's good stuff. It's better than just being a zombie.
Yeah. Would you say that you're happy to be living in interesting times?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, if all of these problems, imagine if Boris Johnson went full 1488 or whatever, and he went really hardcore, and he did everything that we wanted, and he became this kind of God Emperor Boris Johnson, and he abolished democracy and Britain, and he took on the banks, he took it all on and won. And 5 years' time, I'd be sitting just bored out of my head. I would think, you bastard. What do we do now?
I think, on the one hand, yeah, it's good that there is something going on, but also it's good that we are at the cusp of what's going on. And I don't think that's too ambitious a thing to say. I don't think that's too triumphalist. I think it's true. The left is catching up with where we've been, or the centre is catching up. They are now catching up, or trying to. I think we still understand far better than any of the other sectors of the political cultural spectrum the depth and gravity of the problems that we're facing, the predicament that we're in, that Western man is in. And I think that we have always been ahead of the curve. I think we'll probably remain ahead of the curve for quite a long time to come. But it's obviously not fun and games. The life of a dissident is, especially an activist, a figure, someone who's visible, is not all fun. I'm not going to lie about that, but I think it is, in a way, it's a privilege to be at the forefront of this.
Yeah.
All right, I thought you'd have more to say about that. I think that it's, to wrap up, the 2010s would be a very difficult decade to characterize, except to say it seems like a long prelude to something that's going to be 10 years of turmoil. If you're going to split things up by decades, the 2020s is going to be a decade of turmoil in the cultural, economic, political, and technological spheres. So I think that we have to approach this with an open mind and try to take stock of what has been achieved and just be brave and stick together, really. So, Morgoth, any final thoughts on all of this before we sign off?
I don't even really think too much about any kind of. I think one of the problems when people get frustrated, when people get black-pilled, as they call it now, it's because they assumed they would dip into this for a while, and then they'd sort of, everything would be okay. We would go back to normal. Yeah, maybe it would take a while, but the policies would be in place. And when people get deeply pessimistic is when they realize that that's not the case. And so if you resign yourself that you're going to be in this struggle for the rest of your life, it's because, and you're probably not going to see any kind of final victory, then what you do is you just go with it, and it becomes part of your routine, and that's the way, because it's one of the things that when people, they like to read right-wing thinkers who talk about eternal struggle and strife and things, and there's a misconception that an easy life was always going to be guaranteed to us, and it wasn't. That's been taken away, and it's not going to come back anytime soon. So if you're going to imbibe all this right-wing literature about the normal state of life being struggle, then this is it. And, you know, it's great. Look at the scale of the forces that you're up against, you know. Look how pathetic. What Owen Jones is angry about, like Tommy Robinson or Peter Hitchens' article or something like that.
They're all angry about us.
And they're all angry against us. We're angry at the modern world. Where it's the most powerful behemoth that has ever existed on this planet. If you're going to have an enemy in there, I'll take that one. Yeah. And I'll do my best to enjoy fighting it.
Mm. And as was said in my millennial last night with Garrod Murphy, these are our enemies, these are our opponents, and they have to exert enormous pressure and energy and expend enormous amounts of money just to combat us as we are today. And I think that alone is a white pill. It's something, you know, we are not strong just now, and yet we are having this. And I'm not being sort of congratulatory. I'm sort of amazed at this myself. The dissident right is having this cultural effect, even at the scale that it's currently operating at. If we are able to grow, as I predict we will in the 2020s, I really think we're going to have an enormous effect. And I don't think that that the forces ranged against us will. I don't think they'll have an easy time combating us. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And keep things simple. And as I said on our video, because we've got a lot of young lads who have a hard time in one world, get yourself a dog, get yourself a fishing rod, get out, get some fresh air. It does you the world of good. But don't expect much, because you won't get it.
I think you've got to just take this as it comes. People are saying the 2020s is going to be a great decade, fantastic time to be alive, and we'll look back on it with amazement. That could be true. I think it probably will be true. I think also just take it as it comes and try to prepare for the future as much as you can. And yeah, don't do anything crazy, as I once said. Try not to get carried away, basically. All right, Morgoth, would you like to end it there?
Well, thanks a lot. I've seen that it's been very busy in the chat. We've had a lot of people listening, so thanks a lot, folks. It's always a pleasure, and I'll catch you later.
Yeah. Okay, this has been the longest stream by far, this millennial. I think also by far the most viewed, although I haven't really been keeping any eye on that, to be honest, throughout millennial. But it's been very, very interesting. I think a lot of people have enjoyed it. I know that the live chat has been very glowing with praise for Morgoth. So people are saying thanks for a fantastic stream. This was a terrific conversation. But my GF needs to know what your shirt says. Oh, well, I can solve that for you before we go off. It says, "I have a cunning plan." So there you go. And
at least somebody does.
All right. Let's just leave it at that before I think we're both fading a bit. And I don't want to say things.
I'll say thanks for Woz. Thanks to Woz for another great millennial as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
That's my final word, and I'm out. Catch you later, folks.
Okay. See you later, everyone. This has been, a fantastic... I mean, I've enjoyed it very much. People seem to have really enjoyed it. So thanks for watching. I will be back with you on New Year's Day with an AMA on the live channel, MW Live. And then hopefully some videos to follow that. But in the meantime, this was a pleasure to do and a privilege to do. So thank you very much for watching, and I will see you all later.